Which Pebbles is your favorite? Fruity Pebbles with me, John Cena, captain of Team Fruity. It's part of my complete breakfast. Are you fan enough to join me? Fruitacular. Mmm.
Fruity, delicious, delicious. Fruity, fruity, fruity. Fruity, delicious, delicious. Fruity, oh Lord. Fruity, fruity Skittles.
Love the Skittles.
I love the Skittles.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Captain Fruity. Is that really the best name that they could come up with? Captain Fruity? I don't know about that one. This is episode 325 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 27, 2014. I am the Solomonster. You can listen to this podcast each and every Sunday on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes. We're also now streaming on player.fm. We have a free Android app in the Google Play Store. We have an unofficial fan-made Sound Off app created by one of our listeners for Windows 8. On PC and tablets. There's a mobile version coming out later this year. And a big thank you to TV Tracks as well, who's been a big fan of the podcast and posts clips from the show on his YouTube channel each and every week. So no shortage of ways to get your Sound Off content each and every week. Thanks to everybody who's been signing up for the Audible trial with our URL, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You could sign up, free 30-day trial, try out the service, you get one free audio book. That you get to keep whether you continue beyond the 30 days or not. I heard from one of our listeners, Orlando, this week, who bought a copy of Kevin Smith's Tough Shit book, which I have not read, but I've heard good things about. And let me know, because like I said before, whatever books you guys try out, they're audio books, but I want to know because we can pass word along to other people here on the Facebook group, and maybe it's something I want to check out. There's some cool books out there, so give that a shot. It's a way to support the show. They have a good service. Like I said, 30 days, you could try it out. If you don't like it, there's no commitment. And if you do, you just continue on. But if you're going to sign up, do so at audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Got some PayPal shout-outs to get out of the way here. PayPal nicknames for those who have donated to the show. You can donate on thesolomonster.com anytime you want to, whatever you want to. The donation box is always up there. So I want to give a big shout-out to Ben Ironclaw Crawford, Born to be Wild, Brandon Kelly, War Machine, Clay Edwards, who hopefully Clay's listening right now, he's doing well, The Con Man, Michael Connolly, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Keith the Conqueror Krajnik, so you can forget about Brock Lesnar, Keith is the real conqueror, and Canadian Dynamite, Cole Bloxham. Cole made an incredible donation to the show, and I've contacted him directly already to express my gratitude, but I want to do so again here on the show. Big, big thank you to him. Big thank you to everybody who has donated. It's one thing to download the podcast every week and say that you love it, but to actually make a donation, however big or small, and take some of your hard-earned money and put it towards the show and PayPal it over is something I really appreciate. I think it's really cool, and I do this again. Just it's a cool thing to express my gratitude. It's a small gesture. If you make a donation of $10 or more, we do the whole nickname thing. It's just a fun thing to do. So, big thank you to everybody who supported the show this week. And again, if you want to do so, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see it there on the right-hand side. Thanks to everybody for the feedback after the Warrior documentary talk on the show last week. A lot of people have watched the documentary. They're pretty much in sync with what I thought. They thought it was phenomenal, one of the best things WWE has ever done, if not the best kind of documentary piece they've ever worked on. And I know they've done a lot of great DVD pieces, you know, the CM Punk Best in the World documentary. It's a little bit different because those things were a lot longer. This was only an hour long. The Punk thing, I think, was like well over 2 hours. So it was a lot longer. They had a lot of footage from him working on indies and stuff like that. I don't want to sit here and compare which was better. They were both excellent, but the Warrior piece just blew me away. And so I did a column for Yahoo. I kind of mentioned this at the end of the show last week. That there might be a column going up on Yahoo. It went up a lot quicker than I thought, which was great. And so big thank you to those who have read it, passed it around, retweeted it, shared it. It's still up if you want to look for it. You could just punch in my name and, you know, in Google, Warrior Documentary, Yahoo, and put my name, and it'll come right up. But for the people who have read the article and shared their feedback, thank you for that. I hope to have more going up in the near future and have another fun announcement to make in the next week or so. Before we move on to the Raw review and some of the WWE stuff, and I'll talk briefly about Legends House. There really isn't much to say, but I'll talk about that. But I want to comment on some pretty awful stories that were in the news this week in regards to indie wrestling. I know there are a lot of indie wrestling fans who listen to this podcast. I know there's a lot of indie wrestlers who listen to this podcast. Some of them I'm friends with. And, you know, you read stories a lot about bad promoters, crooked promoters, guys getting stiffed out of money, and it just makes you shake your head. You feel bad for the wrestlers because, you know, they don't deserve that. And I don't know if it's more a situation where a lot of these guys are just way in over their heads, and maybe they overbook talent, or they just don't know what they're doing, or they have these grandiose ideas, and then in the end, the money just isn't there. And you kind of have a little sympathy, I guess, for people like that. You like to think that they mean well, and it's not a situation where they're out to screw people. But we had two incidents that were in the news this week that really, you know, just as a wrestling fan, made me pretty angry just reading about it. And it was one right after the other, and both happened to involve indie events that kind of focused on the extreme theme. So one was Extreme Rising, the other was Hardcore Road Trip, a lot of former ECW personalities, and not just former ECW guys. It wasn't like a reunion of all the older talent, but a lot of newer guys on these shows, some big names on these shows. It wasn't just independent guys trying to make a name for themselves. It was a combination of both. And earlier in the week, you know, Extreme Rising was supposed to have a series of shows this weekend. I know people who told me they had paid in advance, some close to $100 or more for their tickets. They were really looking forward to the event. It was going to be at the old ECW Arena in Philadelphia. There was a lot of drama going on in terms of the promoter, Steve O'Neill. He's had a falling out with a number of people, not the least of which was Shane Douglas many months ago. But there was a whole back and forth, I think, on social media with the promoter and Luke Hawks, who is one of the, I think he was the champion, actually, of the Extreme Rising promotion, who had a beef with the promoter and just, you know, the back and forth insults, mostly from the promoter. And as it turned out, the Extreme Rising shows did not take place this week, and they were all canceled. It was more, you know, more or less a last minute thing. A lot of guys got screwed out of money they could have made. They got screwed out of bookings that, had they known in advance that the events were not going to happen, they could have perhaps gotten themselves booked elsewhere. And maybe some were able to at the last minute. But just another situation where you have a promoter who doesn't communicate with people. You know, their Facebook page was taken down. Their Twitter account was deleted. I mean, and that right there is such a shady move. You know, that you're going to tuck your tail and run, that you don't even want to deal with people. You don't want to deal with the repercussions of the situation. So you just delete all your accounts and you disappear. So a lot of people got screwed out of money, both wrestlers and fans. You know, the fans were told, contact your credit card or your bank to try to get a refund. I don't know that anybody has gotten a refund, at least not yet. So a lot of people got fucked over by this guy. The guy's name is Steve O'Neill. And you hear about this other situation that kind of unfolded last night. There was an indie event in London, Ontario, Canada. A Hardcore Road Trip promoted by Mark Livingston is the name of the promoter. A lot of name personalities involved in the show. Steven DeAngelis, I saw the YouTube or Facebook video, maybe it was. Somebody shot video from the end of the show of all the wrestlers in the ring at the end of the night. Steven DeAngelis, who was the old ECW ring announcer. He was also on one or both of the ECW One Night Stand pay-per-views many years ago. So he was also involved in that old ECW, and he was a name from back then. And you know, you hear him on the microphone having to explain the situation to all the fans and what happened with the promoter and how angry he is. And the thing that made that situation so awful is that it wasn't just a matter of Livingston leaving the venue before the event was over, and so, therefore, a lot of guys who did not get their money up front were not paid. That was the situation, it appears, with Extreme Rising. Similar situation, a lot of guys just got fucked out of money. And on top of all that, you had a lot of guys who had no way of getting to the airport to board a flight back home because the transportation situation wasn't sorted out by Livingston in advance. So you have these guys now who are up north in Canada. They're in a foreign country and have no way of getting on their flight to come back home to the States. So you had a lot of wrestlers who had to get fans with passports to provide them transportation to the airport, or else they were stranded. So I don't know how all their situations got worked out. I know some of the wrestlers had fans who were able to pick them up. The fans came through. And it's really shitty when, you know, the fans have to kind of step up where the promoter doesn't have the guts to do so. And I don't know what his excuse was. Supposedly his wife had taken him around the corner to a hospital and something was going on. But again, the lack of communication. They couldn't get a straight answer on exactly what the hell happened. And a whole bunch of guys, at least as of right now, have not been paid. So that makes two different promoters in the span of a week for these indie events fucking the fans over, fucking the talent over. And, you know, the nature of independent wrestling is such where, you know, it's not regulated. Anybody who says, I want to promote a wrestling show can pretty much do it. You know, I don't think it's a terribly difficult thing if you wanted to, even without any experience, to promote an indie wrestling show. And there's a lot of guys out there who have done that, people that I know who have done indie wrestling shows who have no previous experience, who do a kick-ass job. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to promote, you know, any sort of event, really. If you've got the resources, if you've got the talent, and you've got a venue, you can pretty much do it. But I think that's part of the problem, is that there is no, you know, there's no set criteria here. There is no, you know, background check that you can do on these guys. And, you know, the wrestlers are pretty much at the mercy of the promoter. You know, they can pick and choose who they want to work for. Some guys can do that because, you know, they don't have to be at the mercy of an indie promoter. They don't need the work. You know, if they want to work for you, they will. And if they don't, they won't. Some guys don't have that luxury. Some guys need the work. You know, and those are the guys that you feel sorry the most for, because they're the ones getting screwed over here. And in some cases, with both of these events, you had this, you know, wrestlers who were supposed to be both at the Extreme Rising show and I think also at the Hardcore Road Trip show. So imagine those guys getting fucked over twice in one weekend. You know, that's got to be a shitty situation for them. And it gives indie wrestling a black eye. You know, I've been to indie wrestling shows myself. I don't go as much as I probably should or would like to. But I've been to some shows before, and you know, they're a lot of fun. You know, they're not WWE, but so what? You know, it's nice to have an alternative to WWE. I've been to indie wrestling shows before, and 9 times out of 10, I have a blast. And it's really crappy that kind of the whole indie wrestling scene gets painted, you know, with a broad brush when you have a few bad apples like that. The thing I wish that there was, I wish there was some sort of registry that existed. If somebody could put together like an indie wrestling registry where indie wrestlers have to sign up on their own, nobody's forcing them to do so, but you can kind of register and have some sort of database where when you have a promoter who's a scumbag, who screws you over and pulls a stunt like these two clowns did this weekend, they pretty much get blackballed from wrestling and they can't promote again. Because you've had a lot of guys who have fucked people over and then come back months later, years later, and they promote again. And they pull the same stunt. Maybe they don't do it here. Maybe they do it overseas. There are promoters who have screwed multiple people over multiple times. I don't want these two assholes to be two people who can come right back and do the same thing again. So a guy like a Steve O'Neill or a guy like a Mark Livingston should be put into this registry, if it existed, into this database, where indie wrestlers can check periodically to tell, okay, who's the scumbag of the week? Who should we avoid this week? So that way they know who these guys are, and they can make a more informed decision about whether or not, if they come calling, whether or not the wrestlers want to work for these people. And if enough wrestlers know, hey, this guy's a scumbag, we're not going to work for him, and nobody wants to work for these guys, then those guys can't promote anymore, because you need talent to promote. So I wish there was a way, I wish there was a mechanism to create something like that. Maybe there is, and I haven't thought much beyond it on a very basic level here. But that would be something I think that would be very beneficial. These guys get branded for life, they get put into a database, they can't work in wrestling again, and we could try to root out the bad apples. I mean, you're always going to have promoters who, you know, aren't nice guys, or that guys don't want to work with for one reason or another. It's different to be an asshole who promotes wrestling, as opposed to an asshole who promotes wrestling and doesn't live up to his promises or pay the talent. There's a big difference there. And I'm surprised, you know, these guys in a way have gotten off real easy, because at some point they're going to pull a stunt like this and they're going to piss off the wrong person. They're going to piss off the wrong wrestler, and they're going to have to face the consequences of that. And the consequences of that are not going to be a lawsuit. It's not going to be an angry phone call. It's going to be a lot worse than that. And I'm kind of surprised we haven't heard stories about that. You know, maybe it's happened before. Maybe certain promoters have disappeared, and we're just not aware of it. It could be a lot worse for these guys, and they keep pulling stunts like this. At some point, they're gonna reach a point where something's got to give, and they're going to pay a very heavy price for that. I would not want to have to confront a bunch of angry, you know, big jacked up wrestling guys looking for money if I don't have the money to pay them. And in this case, again, I don't know if it's just that these guys meant well. You know, people have worked with them before and they came through, but here they just were in over their heads. The money just wasn't there. They panicked. They didn't know what to do. Yeah, maybe they did. Maybe they panicked. Maybe in a week when things settle down, they'll contact one of the wrestling sites and they'll do an interview and they'll apologize and they'll explain the situation and tell people, you're all going to get your money back. It's probably very doubtful that's going to happen, but it's possible. But if there was some sort of registry or database, their name goes right in there, and at least guys then can go through there and say, okay, I'm not going to work for this guy. I don't want to work for that. Oh, wow, you know, I heard good things about this guy, but wow, he's in the database. Here's why. Here's what he did. You know what? I'm going to stay away from that guy. Again, maybe I'm talking pie in the sky here, and there's no way to have something like that, but it would be nice for these guys to have a tool at their disposal so they can at least be more informed. And if they do work for a guy who's got a spotty record, then you know what? They get what they deserve. If they know going in that this guy has pulled stuff like this before and they choose to work for them anyway, that's on the wrestler. But I'm sure you had a lot of guys who probably were all booked up for the shows this weekend and didn't know. They didn't work for the guys before. They just didn't know, and they got screwed over. But, you know, at its core, it's still independent wrestling. You know, it's not regulated. There is no system in place. That's what makes it independent. These guys can go out there. They can pick and choose who they work for. And the promoters are not bound by any sort of rules and regulations, I guess, beyond building code. And it's kind of the Wild West out there. That's just how it is. But you can put certain things in place, I think, certain measures in place where these guys can at least be a little more safe when it comes to choosing who they work for. I'm curious what all the independent wrestlers who were listening to this think. So, you know, contact me directly. Let me know if I'm kind of missing the ball here. If you agree, or ideas that you may have. I'd love to hear from the perspective of an independent wrestler, or especially somebody who has dealt either directly with either of these two guys or some other scumbag promoter before and wants to share their story. Be very curious to hear from you guys. But yeah, I feel bad. I feel bad for the wrestlers who got screwed over, the fans, especially with the Extreme Rising situation. You know, at least with Hardcore Road Trip, they got a show. It was the wrestlers, for the most part, who got fucked over. On the Extreme Rising stuff, it was a combination of the wrestlers and the fans who got screwed over. And you're going to have fans who probably look at that now and go, you know what, the hell with this. I want to go to an indie wrestling show, and this is what happens. I'm out $50. I'm out $100. I'm not going to go to an indie show ever again. And that hurts the wrestlers, and that's a really shitty situation. I mentioned Legends House earlier. I did catch episode 2 on the WWE Network Thursday night. I'm liking Legends House so far. There isn't really much to talk about because there isn't much that happens on the show. It's not a show that you should go out of your way at all to watch. If you've got an hour to spare, then by all means. But there just isn't much to it. It's a very basic show. You know, this week the guys went to play polo. They were afraid of riding horses. And, of course, the idea that they would put these guys on horses at their age and in some cases in their physical condition is comical. So, of course, they put them in golf carts instead. And hilarity ensued and tensions flared. And then we had another situation where they were going to be cooking dinner and somebody didn't take the food out to unfreeze it in time. And it became a whole drama in the house. There really just isn't much to it. That's really all that I can say. It was fun for what it was. It was a fun way to spend 60 minutes before NXT went on. And I do enjoy some of the personalities on the show. I said last week, Hillbilly Jim just comes off as such a nice guy. Hillbilly Jim comes off as the kind of guy you just want to go share a beer with and tell stories, or listen to him tell stories. And Howard Finkel, I'm a big Finkel fan. They show Finkel trying to do some exercise on the show because Finkel's, you know, put on some weight, obviously, over the years. Howard's a bigger guy than he was before. That was another scene in the episode. They did a Zumba class, which was mildly entertaining, watching Roddy Piper hit on all the women in the Zumba class. Tony Atlas was Tony Atlas. I don't think Tony Atlas goes anywhere ever wearing a shirt with sleeves. He's always sleeveless. And I guess if I had guns like he does, I'd probably walk around without sleeves too. You know, Mean Gene was Mean Gene. He's good with the one-liners and stuff like that. Jim Duggan's another one. Hacksaw comes up pretty well on the show also. Very nice guy. Piper's the one who comes off having the most issues. And speaking of that, I was able to get a copy from a friend of mine of the Roddy Piper kayfabe commentary. I think this was the shoot interview that he did. There was a preview out for it recently, the Timeline 1984, I guess it is. It's like a three-hour or three-and-a-half-hour long shoot. Very much looking forward to diving into that. Although I'm a little afraid. You know, you watch the trailer, and it comes off as Piper telling fun stories, but Piper also gets a little too deep, maybe, you know, probably a little too much, and some of the stories that it looks like he goes into or just, you know, touches upon. So very interested to check that out and kind of dive into the psyche of Roddy Piper, as frightening as that sounds. So anyway, it was a good show. It's not the sort of thing that you're really missing much if you're not seeing it, if you don't have a network subscription, like, oh, I can't believe I'm missing Legends House. You're really not missing much. I did hear they were starting to consider casting for season two. I don't know if that means they're definitely moving ahead with the second season or not. I mean, I hope they do, just with different personalities. I think it would be interesting to get a completely new group of, like, seven or eight guys in a house together somewhere. Of different legends. So I hope they do it, but it's not anything I'm going to be terribly upset about if they don't. So that's my quick recap of Legends House. We'll see what happens with season three next week. Won't be the same without Gary Busey. It's hard, you know. They had the very first episode had Gary Busey. Yeah, it comes up to be like that should be the season finale. How do you go from having Gary Busey in the opening episode to playing polo and taking Zumba class? Seems like a step down. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Baltimore, Maryland. We'll go into the good, the bad, and the ugly here. Some random Raw observations. First, some sad news coming off what had been called the best 2 weeks of his life. That's what he said on Twitter when he came back from his honeymoon with Brie. Daniel Bryan got some horrible news this week. His father, Buddy, passed away last Monday, 57 years old. Not sure why, they haven't said, but he did pass away suddenly. I guess it was unexpected. Just awful news. And Brian did insist on appearing on Raw. He had missed the previous week because of his honeymoon, so he basically showed up to do an angle with Kane to set up their match at Extreme Rules, and then immediately flew back to Washington to grieve with his family. And to make things even worse, there was an 8-year-old boy, Connor Michalik, who also died this week. He died on Friday at a children's hospital in Pittsburgh. His make-a-wish was to meet Daniel Bryan back when Bryan was one half of Team Hell No, when they were the tag team champions. He really wanted to meet Daniel Bryan. And I remember watching, there was a news segment, they posted the video of it online at the time, of Bryan meeting this kid for the first time, and he actually let Connor put him in the yes lock. And I guess Connor's wrestling nickname, he called himself Stone Crusher. It was a really touching segment. I didn't know that Bryan had kept in touch with the kid. Apparently when Raw, I think maybe when Raw came to Pittsburgh, I think Connor had been to a Monday Night Raw taping, and Connor was an invited guest of Bryan's at WrestleMania 30 this year at the Superdome. He and his family were front row for WrestleMania, so he got to see Bryan beat Triple H, win the title in the main event. They had a picture online of the two of them together, Bryan going up to him in the front row. So that was very cool. But to find that out after finding out your dad died in the same week has got to be a big punch to the gut. So thoughts with Bryan and obviously everybody involved. That's just a really that's a bad week right there. That's a bad week. But the show did go on. Bryan was in the opening segment. He came out. He hugged Brie, who was waiting for him in the ring. Bryan, his eyes were all red. You could tell he had just been crying. He was very emotional. I think had they let him speak on the mic, he probably would have just broken down, so they did not let him speak on the mic. Stephanie came out almost right away before he could even get a word out. And Stephanie was awesome here. Stephanie was at her ultimate bitch here in this segment. She's great in that role. Kane came out of the crowd. His music was playing. Bryan was protecting Brie, and they backed up out of the ring. Of course, Kane didn't come down the aisle. He snuck up from behind them out of the crowd. He's back in the mask and the wig, looking like the old Kane. They're calling him now Demon Kane. That was the buzzword on the show. Michael Cole repeatedly, ad nauseum, kept saying, Demon Kane this, Demon Kane that. So I guess he's a demon now, all of a sudden. I just think it's amazing how many times they can just put the mask back on Kane, and it's like the character is reinvigorated and reinvented. Because as corporate Kane, I thought libertarian Kane, I still think libertarian Kane had a lot of potential. Corporate Kane was just a complete waste of time. He never did anything. He was barely there. You know, he came out to wrestle wearing, a wife beater and sweatpants, I think, or jeans. You know, he looked like your uncle at the end of a Thanksgiving meal when he kind of unbuttons his pants. And I mean, there was nothing to the character. It was just kind of there. It was a huge disappointment. And so all of a sudden, after months of doing nothing and months of like, oh, great, it's Kane. Yeah, he puts the mask and the old costume back on and he runs crazy. He's a crazy man. He's killing this poor guy. And all of a sudden, Kane kind of means something again. Now, I don't know that it's going to last very long, but this was a heavy angle that they did here on this show. He gave Brian 3 tombstones. He tombstoned him on the floor. He tombstoned him on the steel steps. And every time you thought that he was walking away and it was over, he'd come right back. Gave him a tombstone on the announce desk, which didn't even break, so that must have sucked for Brian. So this was a really major injury angle that they did here on the show. Later on, they announced that Brian was taken to a local medical facility because we're not allowed to say the H word on this show. I guess hospital's on the banned list still. And they said he had a stinger and he should be okay. And I'll cut him a little bit of slack here because I'm sure this was all thrown together at the last minute because of what happened to Brian's dad. Nobody expected that to happen. But for fuck's sake, if you're going to do a heavy injury angle like this, I'm begging them. I am begging them to keep these guys out for a while. You know, I think Brian is scheduled to be on Raw this Monday, I think. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure he'll be on Raw this Monday night. There's just no good reason for him to be there. The guy got dropped on his head 3 times. On the floor, on the steps, on the table, which didn't even break. You know, 20 years ago, an attack like that would have kept somebody off television for months. You know, these days, a guy's back on TV the following week. Sometimes not even. Sometimes he's back that Friday. And maybe he's got a bandage on him or he's got a neck brace on, but he's back. It's no wonder nobody takes these injury angles seriously anymore. Well, one of our listeners, Michael from the Bronx, he wrote in. He wrote in for the mailbag, but I want to mention this here. He wrote in suggesting that instead of having Brian physically on the show this Monday as a way to sell the beating, he can be on the show by phone instead, talking about how he's healing up and no matter what the doctors say or anything like that, I will be at the pay-per-view. I will be there to defend my title and get my revenge on Kane. I like that idea. You know, you could even do it via Skype hookup if you want to have video of him on there. You know, you can come up with whatever creative way you want to. Have him via satellite, via phone, whatever. And have him just cut a really angry, intense promo hyping up the match at the pay-per-view. I know there's a pay-per-view next weekend. Brian does not have to physically be on the show this Monday to sell that title match on the show. And the title match is not even being positioned as the main event, so it doesn't matter. The real main event of that show, whether it goes on last or not, is Evolution against The Shield. Brian is not even in the main event. So believe me, if he misses the show on Monday, first of all, I don't think anybody's going to mind. I think people will understand if he's not there. And number two, I almost think it would be more meaningful to do it that way, because everyone's probably expecting him to be on the show anyway. So why not do things a little bit differently and have him by phone or have him by Skype? Skype him in, and he could be there with, you know, a neck brace on or whatever. But just have him cut a really heated promo on Kane, talk about some stuff that's happened in his life. It's been a whirlwind month for him. If they want to incorporate some of that stuff into the promo, I think it could be an even more effective promo if you've got Brian with his eyes all welled up talking about how this went from being the greatest month of his life to being the biggest nightmare of his life. I like that idea a lot. And the example that Michael used in his email was the build for the Ric Flair Vader match back at Super Bowl 94, where Flair called, I think he called in or he left a voicemail or something like that for the president of WCW, that he would be there. He would be there at the pay-per-view to compete and defend his title against Vader. This was after Vader had attacked him, so it's kind of a similar angle. And as Michael said, it made it feel like a bigger deal. And I'd be fine with that. I think that's the way to go. I just think you do an angle like that, you can't have the guy back on TV the week after. You can't do that. Intercontinental title tournament continued. Sheamus and Bad News Barrett had an excellent match. Barrett won clean with the bullhammer elbow, which is huge because Sheamus rarely loses clean. I mean, I know he did to Batista on SmackDown the week before, but that was the exception, not the rule. You know, usually Sheamus is one of those untouchable guys where if he actually does lose, it's because somebody cheated, interfered, hooked the tights, something like that. This was a big win for Barrett. So I figure he's getting the match with Big E at Extreme Rules and probably getting the title. In the other semifinal match, we had Rob Van Dam beat Cesaro by countout after Jack Swagger ran out and ran Cesaro into the ring post. He could not get back in the ring in time, and so Van Dam will meet Barrett in the finals this Monday. This match, not as good as Sheamus and Bad News Barrett. In fact, RVD and Cesaro had a pretty bad match, I thought. I expected these guys to go in there for the first time and have a pretty kick-ass match, but you could tell early on there was a styles clash between the two, even just kind of, you know, Irish whipping the other guy into the ropes and coming off. It looked like they got lost, they got confused, didn't know what they were supposed to do, and so it wasn't a great match. But all I can say about this, thank God Cesaro is out of this tournament. Keep him as far away from that title as possible. It sucks the lifeblood out of anybody who holds it. I finally figured out the other day why Curtis Axel never got over. Because people say, you know, Paul Heyman's a great manager, and if they put you with Paul Heyman, you're going to go to the top. But, you know, not always. Curtis Axel's kind of the exception to that rule. Well, you know what? I was thinking about that, and I realized why Curtis Axel never got over, even after they put him with Paul Heyman last year. It wasn't Heyman's fault. He won the Intercontinental title right after he hooked up with Heyman. That's what led to his downfall. That thing is like the fucking ring from those Ring movies. All you people who think that that's going to change, even if Barrett wins it, okay, prepare to be disappointed. The only way that title might actually start being treated as something special again is if the current people in power in WWE are replaced and they get new people in there. And that's not going to happen. So, you know, you've got the same people otherwise in charge who have booked the title as a steaming pile of crap for years now. So I'm not really sure why you guys think that all of a sudden they had some kind of coming to Jesus moment, you know, with respect to the Intercontinental title. They found God and all of a sudden they're going to book this thing like it should be booked. I don't really know where you're getting that from. It's the same people in power who kept the Intercontinental title off WrestleMania something like 7 or 8 years in a row. By the way, good news is Cesaro now has music. The bad news is it sucks. It's an air raid siren followed by some rock music. I think it'll take some getting used to, but for now, it sucks. Heyman has a new shtick on the mic before the match where he says, "My client Brock Lesnar conquered the streak," and he just says it over and over and over again to the point where my ears bleed. Jay on Twitter had an interesting take on this. He says WWE did not give the streak to Lesnar. What they really did was they gave it to Heyman. That way anybody he manages can benefit from it. And I'm sure that's not why they did it. In fact, I'm almost positive that's not why the streak was broken, just to benefit Paul Heyman. But it's an interesting way of looking at it. I'm not sure if it is benefiting Cesaro so far. Unless the idea here is that months down the road, Heyman bragging about Lesnar leads to Cesaro taking offense. You know, he starts to get bothered by it, and then that builds to a Lesnar-Cesaro match, maybe even a WrestleMania next year. If that's the idea, then by all means, carry on. If the end game here is Cesaro versus Lesnar, I'm all for it. But, you know, he had a lot of babyface momentum. There's still people who cheer for him. They have the Cesaro section signs and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not really sure that him coming out and doing that shtick is helping Cesaro too much right now. But like I said, if they have a long-term plan here and that's the plan, then please, by all means, continue. The streak is over. Randy Orton wore pants to the ring on Monday night. I'm pretty sure he went years without wearing any, which I think is every man's dream, to be able to walk around without wearing any pants. I don't share in that dream personally. If I had my way, I'd walk around everywhere wearing sweatpants. That's my dream. Orton came out with the rest of Evolution, Triple H doing his best Jake the Snake Roberts impression, spoke, even though his voice was nearly gone. The Shield made their way through the crowd. Evolution bailed. Each member got time to cut a promo. Rollins did most of the talking. Way too much. Rollins is a good talker, but he just went on and on here. Roman Reigns kept it brief. He said they had two options. Either they could come up that ramp and they could fight, or Evolution can run away like a bunch of cream puffs. That's an insult I haven't heard since I think I was about seven. They headed up the ramp. All of a sudden, all the heels on Raw came out on stage to protect Evolution. You know, the Shield did nothing here. They kind of backed off. I don't like the way they chickened out here. I know they were outnumbered. I know it was the smart thing for them to back off, you know, 12-on-3 situation there. But these guys were in a handicap match of 11-on-3 the week before, or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, and they did just fine. They held their own. You know, how many times in WWE have we seen the babyface stand up against the odds? I know we've seen John Cena do it, but he's not the only one. We've seen this time and time again. And for the Shield all of a sudden to retreat after Roman Reigns made this ultimatum. You know, if you're going to do an ultimatum and you're a babyface, you kind of have to live up to that ultimatum. He gave them two options, and instead they went with option C. I thought that was kind of lame. If you're going to go down, you may as well go down fighting. The Usos beat the Rhodes Brothers after they pinned Cody. Cody was not happy when the match was over. He shoved Goldust away when Goldust went over to check on him and then walked off. So it begins. There's trouble in the Rhodes family. The highlight of this match, of all things, was Ryback. Ryback was on commentary with Curtis Axel. They're getting the next shot at the tag titles on Raw this Monday. Why Raw this Monday and not the pay-per-view, I don't know. Unless they're going to win the belts and then drop them back to the Usos at Extreme Rules, that really wouldn't make a lot of sense. But anyway, they're the number one contenders. Ryback was awesome here. I know I've crapped on Ryback a lot because they gave up on Ryback a long time ago, and so did I. They had something in the guy. They squandered it. They missed the opportunity. And I don't know that they're ever going to get that opportunity back. So Ryback's just kind of been there. Now he's kind of finding a role for himself with Axel. I find them a little more entertaining. Mostly Ryback I find more entertaining every time he speaks. So maybe giving him more mic time was the key to all that. But he showed more personality here than I've seen out of him his entire run with the company. He burned the announcers, saying they've been working together for years and they still suck. Then he shared a story about his dad bartending back in the day and meeting Kurt Hennig and Scott Hall back when they were both in the AWA. He gave Goldust a backhanded compliment, talking about how great he was for an old guy and how he remembers being 13 years old sitting at the Thomas and Mack Center out in Vegas watching Goldust, and here he is still wrestling all these years later. Ryback's commentary was like finding buried treasure here. I fully endorse him just retiring from active competition and just joining the booth full-time. Emma beat Layla. Diva Stopwatch had this at 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Beat her with her own version of the Cobra, only she used a pink sock puppet instead of a green one. Emma enjoys having pink snakes on her hand. Good to know. This whole Santino-Emma combo is absolutely killing this poor girl. She's, you know, she's on TV, so she's got that much over JTG, I guess, but she's not getting over, and she's much better than this. She comes out, she does the bubbles, she does her stupid dance. I know some people absolutely hate it. They think the dance is stupid. They don't know what people see in her, why she's over on NXT. It became a cult thing on NXT, and I think the reason she got over on NXT, it had nothing to do with the dance by itself or the bubbles or her just acting like a ditz. It had everything to do with her wrestling, because she could act as stupid as she can be, but when she got in the ring, she could wrestle. She has a badass finisher, and she could go. And we haven't really seen her have the chance to show off those skills on TV. She's done her finisher a couple times now, but she's just been branded as this comedy character with Santino, and that's just death. That's absolute death. And they've got to get her away from him as quickly as possible. So I hope they do. I hope they do, because I still say down the road, whether it's next year, 6 months from now, 2 years from now, I think the modern day version of what Trish and Mickey, or even Trish and Lita maybe, was back in the day, people usually look back and they romanticize, oh, the days of Trish and Lita, which is funny because I don't think people would have thought that back then. But I think the closest thing to that we could have this generation with this current crop of girls is Paige and Emma. I think they're like best friends in real life. They worked together on NXT. They had a whole bunch of matches that were actually very good. They had that match on the Arrival special back in February that was awesome. I think if they build these two, and Paige is on her way, but I think Emma is really lost right now, but they've got to change course with her soon and get her on that path, and that could be a big match even next year's WrestleMania. I think if they build it up right, Paige versus Emma for the Divas title could be a huge match next year. Speaking of Paige, she beat Oksana 4 minutes 41 seconds with the Scorpion Crosslock. Kind of a dead match. Nobody really cared. I'm really sick and tired of the announcers getting on Paige about how pale she is. I don't think I ever once heard a mention of that on NXT. I don't think I ever one time heard the announcers talk of all the things to say about Paige when she was in there wrestling and kicking ass on NXT. You know, boy, she's blinding. You got to have blinders on when you look at Paige. She's so pale. She's so milky white. Not once. They never mentioned that one time. You know why? Because there was no reason to mention it. Because she's a great wrestler. People like her. People love Paige. She's over. And people don't give a fuck whether she has a tan or not. She's been on this show a grand total of 3 weeks. And I have to hear about how she needs a tan. Get some new fucking material. I'm waiting now for the inevitable mixed tag matches where they put Sheamus and Paige together, because then the announcers, they'll have a blast. That's all we're going to hear about for 15 minutes is how pale both of them are. You can't see. Got to have sunglasses on. Just get some new fucking material. Main event was John Cena against the Wyatt family in a handicap match. The story throughout the show was they had an app vote, and they let the fans vote on John Cena's fate, which was their first mistake. Although, maybe that was what they wanted. The story they were telling here is that Bray Wyatt is doing a good job, a very effective job, of turning the fans on John Cena. Which is comical to me, because as though the fans didn't turn on John Cena 8 years ago. But anyway, that's the story they're trying to tell. That's what I got out of it. Now, the fans could have voted for a singles match with Cena versus Luke Harper, handicap match with Cena against Harper and Rowan, or the ultimate handicap match of Cena against all three members of the Wyatt family. I'll give you one guess as to what won the app vote. If you guessed all three members of the Wyatt family, then congratulations, you've been paying attention. 53% said Bray Wyatt, Luke Harper, and Eric Rowan should wrestle John Cena. 9% said Harper and Rowan. 38% said Harper, which is actually a lot higher than I thought. Maybe not surprising, though, because Cena and Harper had a hell of a match, a singles match on Raw several weeks ago. Harper's very good. So, the fans voted for John Cena to get annihilated by all three of these guys. The announcers tried to spin the vote as the fans have confidence in John Cena. They believe in him. And then, again, on the post-game show, Josh Matthews is there. He's talking about saying the fans wanted Cena to get his hands on Bray Wyatt. And so that's why they voted to throw him to the slaughter. The only way for him to get his hands on Bray Wyatt, who he's wrestling at the pay-per-view, okay, he's got the issue at Bray, was to pick option C and put him in there against all three. And that's all well and good. There is some logic to that, except that when John Cena did his backstage promo earlier in the show, he definitely was not imploring the fans to vote for option three. He was all scared, and he was hoping the fans would do the right thing. And then when the vote totals were finally counted, they got this great camera shot of Cena looking around at the crowd for like 30 seconds straight with this look that just screamed, you know, I should have turned heel on you ungrateful assholes years ago. So I don't think that's exactly what they were going for here. They tried to spin it. They failed. Boy, did they fail. But they tried. They did try. The match itself, it's like every other handicap match. I mean, it's pretty much been handicap hell ever since the Authority angle started. It's almost like they're so devoid of ideas that when they put these shows together, it's like, well, what can we have for a main event? Well, we can't come up with anything, so let's just put this guy in there with three other guys. Or let's put the Shield in there with 12 people, and we'll have that as our main event. People don't care about handicap matches. Handicap matches are not interesting. They're not exciting, especially when you have a guy in there against three other people, and he beats all three. Which is exactly what happened here. And I'm surprised people actually thought the Wyatts were going to get the win here. John Cena was getting his ass kicked the entire match. I knew exactly where this was going. He made a comeback. He had the match won. Okay, I think he hit the AA on Bray. Went for the pin. Luke Harper ran in for the interference, and the referee called for the bell. So John Cena wins the match by DQ. He got his ass kicked for like 10 minutes straight, and they couldn't just have, you know, he could have a comeback, but then maybe have Bray lay him out with Sister Abigail or something like that. Nope, they couldn't even do that. So they had him win the match, DQ win. Harper gave Cena a big boot after the match. Bray gave Sister Abigail to him and then sat there cradling Cena's head in his lap, singing he's got the whole world in his hands over and over until they went off the air. So this show peaked in the opening segment, that angle they did with Brian and Kane. Was a really good angle, and it would be really effective if they actually kept Brian off the show this week. So that was the highlight. That was the high point of the show. Barrett and Sheamus had an awesome match, easily the best match on the entire show. Everything else was just kind of there. The main event was nothing special. Ryback, to me, if I had to pick one highlight of the show, and I never thought I'd hear myself say this, Ryback was the highlight of Raw Monday night. Actually, when I say that, that kind of sounds like an indictment of the show when Ryback was the highlight, but he was. Raw this Monday is live from St. Louis. Ric Flair is rumored to be making an appearance on the show. Don't think that necessarily means he's back with Evolution. For the people who think, great, Evolution's back together, all four. Not necessarily. I'm not entirely sure that's the case. I'm not saying they're going to beat him down or anything like that, because I don't know that they want Flair taking a beatdown anymore, but I'm not so sure that he's going to be with them at the pay-per-view. Also, Hugh Jackman will be on the show promoting his new X-Men movie. He was one of the better celebrity guests they ever had on the show, and he seems like a cool dude, so that should be fun. Also announced on the show, RVD and Bad News Barrett in the finals of the Intercontinental Title Tournament. I would expect Barrett to go over there. And the Usos defend their tag team titles against Curtis Axel and Ryback. So that is the lineup for Raw this Monday night. NXT this past week saw Paige get stripped of her women's title, that is, by JBL. That sets up a tournament to crown a new women's champion, so they pulled the trigger on that after all, which I figured they would. I mean, hell, if the Warrior had to forfeit his Intercontinental title back in the day when he won the WWE title, then why should Paige not have to go through the same thing? At least they're consistent. So I assume this ends with Charlotte getting the title. She was the one who was getting the push before all this happened, so we'll find out. But that was how NXT opened up, with that segment, JBL confronting her backstage in the hallway. And yeah, it was kind of weird, because at first when JBL told her, listen, I'm taking the title away from you, she protested and said, there's no way, I'm not allowing you to do that. And then JBL had some nice comments about her, and then all of a sudden she changed her mind. She's like, you know what, you're right, here you go. So that was kind of weird. Alexander Rusev beat Travis Tyler in the opening match. Pretty much a squash, as every Rusev match is. At some point, they've got to give the guy some competitive matches. They did the same thing with Ryback at first. Ryback for months. It was Ryback coming out and beating up two dudes, beating up three dudes. It's like they just didn't know what to do with the guy. And then John Cena happened to get hurt, and they lucked into that whole situation where Ryback was getting over finally, and they put him in the match with Punk, and that pay-per-view did really well, and Ryback was at his peak, and then they, you know, they beat him, and you know the rest of the story. So at some point, Rusev has to have some competitive matches. We had Charlotte and Sasha Banks in a tag team Divas match against Paige and Emma. Good match. Talk about the, I want to talk about the head scissors clamp spot here. Charlotte is a great athlete, and she's getting a lot better. It's fun to watch her progress. She kind of reminds me of Summer Rae in that way. Summer Rae, I think, turned into a really good wrestler, and it's a shame she's been gone lately. She's been off doing her filming, I guess, for the Marine Four. When she comes back to TV, I wonder if she'll be back on NXT or if they're just going to keep her exclusively on the main roster now. But Charlotte reminds me of Summer Rae in a lot of ways. Both very long legs. That's one of them. But there was a spot here in this match where Charlotte had, I think it was Emma, in like a head scissors clamp. So Emma's head was between Charlotte's thighs, okay? Kind of sexy. And she did this thing Charlotte did where she turned over, and I expected that she was going to do kind of the skull-crushing spot where she uses her legs and her thighs to repeatedly smash Emma's head into the mat, which she actually did a few minutes later. But what she did the first time was she flipped over. So now, you know, Emma, and again, I'm thinking it was Emma, not Paige. Emma is face down, And Charlotte does a complete flip over. And as she flips over, she kind of flips Emma over with her. Like, it's hard for me to sit here and describe it. It was actually an amazing spot. I didn't see many people giving enough credit to her for that. I watched that and I thought, wow, that's something I've never seen before. And that's what you have to do to stand out. You know, these guys, again, it's a developmental show. So these men and women, they're out there doing their thing, but they're still learning. I mean, a guy like an Adrian Neville, less so. He already has a lot of experience. I don't know how much more, you know, he really has to improve. He's already awesome. But somebody like Charlotte, who's only had, you know, I mean, a handful of wrestling matches. She's only been doing this for a few months. And that's one of those spots I think that she can incorporate into her arsenal going forward to make her stand out. I don't see anybody else doing that. I don't know if anybody else can do that. So it was really impressive. We had Charlotte actually go over here at the finish. Charlotte not only went over and won the match, but she pinned Paige, which is a rare thing. I can't remember the last time I saw Paige get pinned, even in a tag team match on NXT. She did the standing buff blockbuster type move, that cutter that she does. It didn't really look that good either, but Paige, you know, sold it like she was knocked out or whatever. And Charlotte got the pin. Now, what that makes me think is that this was taped before WrestleMania. I'm pretty sure this was the last of a taping that where they taped four shows. This was probably done before WrestleMania, which means this was done before the Raw after WrestleMania, where they debuted Paige and she beat AJ. And it's pretty clear to me that what happened here probably is that Paige winning the Divas title was a last-minute call. Maybe because they knew AJ was leaving and they said, let's bring up Paige and give her the belt on night one. Maybe that's what happened. But between them starting to build to something between Paige and Charlotte for a while there, and then Charlotte getting this clean win in this tag match over Paige, it would make you think that you were headed for a Paige-Charlotte match where Charlotte maybe was going to beat her for the belt, and now they're not going to do that because Paige is on the main roster, so that tells me that was probably a last-minute move. Tyson Kidd beat Mason Ryan, and not only did he beat Mason Ryan, the big guy, bigger than he is anyway, but he got some promo time when the match was over. Now, I'm still not big on all the main event talent, or I should say main roster talent, not main event talent, infecting the show of late. I think they've gone a little overboard having all the main roster guys on this show. You know, a little bit is fine, but we've had the Usos were great, but we've had the Usos, we've had Sheamus, we've had Kali, we had Miz not too long ago. Natalya's on the show like every week or every other week, and a bunch of other guys as well. So Tyson Kidd, though, is a good example, I think, of having main roster talent on the show in a good way. It's clear they're not doing anything with him on Raw or SmackDown. He's got a ton of talent. He can work well. I'm sure with a lot of guys down in NXT, Tyson Kidd could go in there and have a kick-ass match and not only look good himself, but make them look good as well, which I think should be the point of having him down there. So if the plan is to have him down there now, you know, Cesaro used to be the guy for a long time, even though he was on the main roster. Cesaro would make appearances and wrestle, just randomly wrestle on NXT, and he was loved. I mean, he was beloved down there. He was over big time as a babyface, no matter what he did. He had a great match, I remember, with Regal. He had that match with Sami Zayn, multiple matches with Sami Zayn. It looks to me like Cesaro now finally has transitioned off of NXT, and I wonder if Tyson Kidd is kind of the old veteran-type guy now they're going to have from the main roster pop up on the show here. We'll find out, but if that's the case, I don't mind it. It's a hell of a lot better than having the great Kali on this show. Let's just put it that way. I say keep him around and make him an established part of the show is what I say. Tyler Breeze beat Angelo Dawkins. Angelo Dawkins is one of those NXT guys who'll pop up every now and then. They don't really have a role for him. Usually he's in there to lose to whoever his opponent is. He came out this week dressed up as some kind of cross between Percy Watson and Steve Urkel. It's the best way I can describe it. At first, when he first walked out, I thought it was Percy Watson, who they released from developmental a long time ago. And then I saw he had a backpack on, you know, and I thought of Urkel. He had the glasses on. He was doing this weird, wacky dance. So I guess that's his new gimmick. What the hell the gimmick is supposed to be, I don't know. I guess a dancing high school student. That's the best that I could come up with, you know, in terms of just looking at the guy. Thankfully, he did not beat Tyler Breeze. That would have been quite the atrocity. Breeze made short work of Angelo Dawkins, beat him with the beauty shot, which is the spinning heel kick. And all I could say is, Do more with this man. Tyler Breeze should be doing a hell of a lot more than wrestling enhancement matches on NXT. Been there, done that, time to move on and get him into a program. We had footage from last week's episode that we did not see when they went off the air. Adrian Neville had been laid out by Brodus Clay. We didn't see how. We just saw Brodus standing over him with referees trying to hold him back, and Neville's laying on the floor, and they show Neville, and we see what appears to be teeth laying on the ground in front of Adrian Neville, and we're told that his teeth got knocked out by Brodus Clay. And I thought to myself, wow, that is kind of fucked up. If, let's say, Brodus Clay actually did clock him a little too hard, knock his teeth out, especially since it was a backstage angle last week that they didn't even show. All we saw was the guy laying there with his teeth on the ground. I sure hope that he didn't really get his teeth knocked out. And from what I've been told by some of you guys, and this kind of makes sense, you know, Neville, when he wrestles, wears a mouth guard. I just thought it was part of the gimmick, but it may have something to do with some dental issues he's had before, so he may have some fake teeth in his mouth, kind of like Joe Park does. Remember Joe Park was doing that character on TNA, all of a sudden he had all his teeth. Or even Mick Foley. Mick Foley, when he was doing the corporate thing way back when and wrestling Steve Austin, he'd come out with fake teeth. He'd put his teeth in. Jim Ross would mock him on commentary for it. So it looks like that may be the case here. He has the false teeth from whatever may have happened, maybe in a match on the Indies. He got him knocked out many years ago. And that may be why he wears the mouthpiece. So here, for added effect, to make Brodus Clay out to be a big monster, they did the angle where he just kind of pulled out the fake teeth, and it's like, oh, look at this, he knocked his teeth out. That at least makes more sense to me, so I'm assuming that's what happened. Sami Zayn and the Usos in the main event beat Corey Graves and The Ascension. I was a little worried going into this match, I gotta be honest with you, because Corey Graves and The Ascension together is the cure for insomnia. Those are not some of my more favorite acts on NXT. But this match turned out to be pretty good. It built nicely, a little slow, but it built nicely. Until the last 2 or 3 minutes, that's when it really got good. Zayn nailed his Yakuza kick in the corner on Graves. And then Zayn and one of the Usos, I don't know who, they did a double dive onto Victor and Connor on the outside, wiping them out. That left the other Uso in the ring. Corey Graves was down. The Uso nailed the big splash off the top, 1, 2, 3, and that is your main event. So, a good match. Again, having guys like Tyson Kidd and the Usos on NXT can make the show better. That doesn't mean I want to see the Usos there every week, but it beats having the great Kali on the show. That's all I can say about that. Now, the big news with NXT was Triple H made the announcement in front of the roster. They showed video of it online. That there will be another live NXT special on the WWE Network. It's coming up on May 29th, so it's a Thursday night again. Same thing, live 2 hours at 8 Eastern. It's called NXT TakeOver. So they now have a month to build to this special. I know they just had a set of NXT tapings. I have not read all the match spoilers. I just don't want to know. But I did see the lineup for the special so far, which kind of gives a few things away. So if you don't want to know the top three matches set for TakeOver, if you don't want some spoilers here, skip ahead a couple of minutes. You've been forewarned. We've got Adrian Neville defending his NXT title against Tyson Kidd in the main event, which I think should be a phenomenal match. And a big win for Neville, too. I have to assume the idea here is that they bring in Kidd to give him the kind of match that Adrian Neville really should be having. You know, it's hard when you put Adrian Neville in there with a guy like a Brodus Clay. There have been some really good big man, little man matches in the past. Those two guys had a match last week. I didn't think it was particularly good. And I'm not looking forward to the rematch. But you put Neville in there with a guy more his size, more his speed. And that's kind of what he was known for on the Indies, for going out there and having phenomenal matches with guys that were probably more along the lines of his size. So if the idea was to bring Tyson Kidd in, give Tyson Kidd some big wins over guys like Mason Ryan. I'm sure he'll beat a few other guys, build him up, give him some credibility, and then give him a title shot, and then give Neville a big win out of it after a kick-ass match. That's great. That's what I assume is going to happen here, and that's a main event that I'm actually looking forward to. Natalya and Charlotte will have a match to determine the new NXT Women's Champion, so I guess they make it all the way to the finals. Can't see Natalya winning. I think it's pretty obvious how this one's going. And I said before, in a very short period of time, Charlotte has improved a lot since her debut. So I would expect her to win here, have a lengthy run with the belt. Paige had the belt. Paige was the only women's champion they ever had. I think she was champion for like 200 and something days. I don't know if she'll have quite, a reign quite that long. But what I can see here is there have been issues before with Charlotte and Bayley. You remember they used to be friends. Charlotte turned on her and joined the, what's the name of their group? The BFFs. So they kind of left that unresolved. I could see Bayley. I don't see Bayley beating her for the belt, but I could see Charlotte getting the belt, and then her first feud maybe is with Bayley to kind of tie up those loose ends. The other match announced for the special, Tyler Breeze and Sami Zayn in a match to determine the number one contender for the NXT Championship. I love Sami Zayn, but it's about damn time they get in gear with Breeze and give the guy a shot. I'd have him win here, maybe with a little assist from the debuting Sami Callihan. Solomon Crowe, whatever you want to call him. You know, he's still waiting in the wings. He has not made his TV debut yet. This would be a good place to debut somebody new and have him make an impact, so why not? You know, that way Tyler Breeze goes on to feud with Neville. He'll get the next title shot. And Sami Zayn, in the meantime, now has a program. He's got an issue with Crowe, and they can probably have some good matches too. So that works for me. That's one idea that I would probably shoot for if I had my run of things, which I don't. But anyway, anything but Sami Zayn and Corey Graves is okay with me. Graves, you know what it is? Graves just bores me. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he has a leg-based submission. And so a lot of his offense, when you watch his matches, it consists of working over the leg, working over the knee. And that's really all there is to it, and that's after a while, that's boring. There's just not much else there. And maybe it also is just part of the fact that he's a heel, and maybe as a babyface, he was better. I've had people who have been watching NXT longer than me, who Graves and I think Neville used to be a tag team. They feuded, I think, and then they became a tag team. That I remember. I don't remember Graves' matches being that much different as a babyface, although I guess he was good at selling like the babyface beatdowns and then making a big comeback and that kind of stuff. Maybe part of it is he's just not a good heel. He's boring as a heel, but maybe he's more exciting as a babyface. I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with the submission stuff, and he just doesn't do it for me. And it's not just the stuff with Sami Zayn. It goes back to Neville. When he was having those matches with Adrian Neville, they were so boring. They were so boring. So I don't know what you do with the guy. He's got a good look. He talks well. I could see him being a star on the main roster. I think he was one of the guys last year when I did the prediction show for 2013 who I said he's one of the guys to watch for in terms of NXT guys who may be promoted to the main roster. Now, he wasn't, but I do think that eventually he'll make it up and he'll probably do well for himself. But there's like a spark missing with the guy, and I don't know what it is. I think what I just talked about probably has a lot to do with it. And he just not one of my favorites right now on NXT, and the Ascension as well. The Ascension, you can tell they're making tweaks to their character. The fans are getting behind them now, and they better be careful here, because if the idea is not to turn them babyface, then they've got to make a change soon, because by sending them out there every week without any sort of direction, without any sort of feud, they just go out there. They're like a modern-day version of the Road Warriors, where they go out and they beat people up, and at some point, that will turn you babyface. The people like that. The people want to see you go out there and kick ass. And if that's the goal, it seems to be working, because the fans are reacting a little bit more to them, and they're a little less demonic. They don't have like the old like Undertaker gothic-type entrance now. They're a little more human. You know, they don't wear the weird eye contact lenses anymore and that kind of stuff. But they're another act that just kind of bores me when they're out there. There's not much substance there. Part of that may be we don't hear from them. When they talk, it's very brief, and they have, take your soul, like that kind of stuff. And there's got to be more to it than that. There just has to be. There has to be more substance there. So that goes for Graves and for the Ascension. You know, hopefully they'll continue to kind of tweak their acts and give them more to say, give them more to do. Maybe I'll have a change of heart on that. But right now, they're some of my least favorite acts on the show. But guys like Zayn, guys like Breeze, it's nice to see them doing more with them. Hopefully they'll continue in that direction. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to TakeOver on the 29th. You know, if they do these every 2 months or so, I'm cool with that. I think they should. I think they should do more live NXT specials every year. Maybe not every month, but if they want to do one every other month, fine by me. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. It is time for the Impact Review. So this was a weird show. You know, there was some good wrestling on it, but it was also the final Impact before their Sacrifice pay-per-view tonight. And in terms of promoting that pay-per-view and making me want to see it, I mean, I wouldn't see it anyway, but making me want to see it, it was a horrendous show in that way. You know, in fact, I'm not even going to bother running down the card for the show tonight, because if TNA cannot be bothered to make people care about it, then why the hell should I? I hope they do 5,000 buys tonight and never do another pay-per-view ever again. You know, you're down to 4 shows a year, and you still can't do an adequate job of promoting it. So why even have 4? Why not just scrap them all? I'm rooting for Ring of Honor in June. I really think they have a good shot of outdrawing TNA in pay-per-view buys for their very first show. I hope they do it. Opening segment was Magnus and Abyss in the ring. Magnus came out with what looked to be a wrench. It was actually part of the turnbuckle, the metal part of the turnbuckle. And Abyss came out. Abyss seemingly is in the midst of a babyface turn here. He was talking about how he only partnered up with Magnus because Magnus gave him a sense of belonging. And Magnus, he threatened to kick his ass. Magnus reminded him, you know, you're not under contract to TNA. You're under contract to me for my services. And since you did me no good and I lost my title, you are hereby fired. So then MVP came out. MVP said, listen, Abyss, I will give you a chance to win a contract with TNA. This whole thing is so goofy, by the way. You know, this guy's been with TNA for how many years now? And we're supposed to believe he had no contract with TNA, even though he's wrestled on Impact now how many weeks? He had the Monstrous Ball match with Eric Young. He had a bunch of other matches that apparently was okay because he was under contract to Magnus, even though he wasn't under contract to TNA. Makes no sense. But MVP said, I'll give you a chance to win a contract, and I'll put you in a match with Magnus tonight. So that set up the main event. Kurt Angle annihilated Rockstar Spud, tapped him out in 2 minutes with the ankle lock. He was throwing this guy around. Angle looked good here. It's amazing when you put somebody in the ring with Kurt Angle who's, you know, half his size, how much more impressive Angle seems. EC3 was out there. He clipped Angle's knee when the match was over, tried to re-injure it when Willow ran down to make the save. It's going to be Angle and Willow as tag team partners against EC3 and Rockstar Spud at the pay-per-view tonight. The Beautiful People came down to the ring, confront Madison Rayne. They wanted to give Madison a makeover. They talked, and they talked, and they talked. And finally, Madison Rayne acted like she was sorry, but then she said she was sorry that she had to do this. And she attacked Angelina. Velvet then attacked her. This brought out their new knockout, Brittany, to make the save. She did a poor job of that since she got dispatched very quickly. Velvet then gave Madison a pedigree, and Angelina put a paper bag over Madison's head, which I'm told is an old Beautiful People gimmick from days that I really was not paying much attention to TNA. So I was not aware of that, but I guess that's their old shtick. I just remember that from when Cody Rhodes was doing it. Cody Rhodes was putting paper bags over people's heads years ago. I don't know which came first. But anyway, as with everything in TNA, right after she put the paper bag over her head, they cut away. And we see Mr. Anderson driving around Sam Shaw's hometown looking for his childhood home. So don't worry, it gets worse. Backstage, Gail Kim turned babyface, or so it seems. She told Madison that she wanted to team with her against Angelina and Velvet. That match came later on and was pretty bad. Beautiful People won with a cradle on Madison, handful of tights. I'm not buying this Beautiful People reunion so far. You know, Velvet Sky was the number one babyface knockout in TNA for a while. Then she got demoted, okay, with the Chris Sabin stuff. She was subservient to Sabin. Well, now Sabin's gone, and Angelina's back, and Velvet's in a supporting role again as a heel. And why? What's so special about Angelina Love? I don't get it. Maybe somebody can fill me in, because I don't see it. MVP had promised a mystery opponent for Kenny King, who is such a talented guy, he has to show up every single week to TV begging for a match. Well, he got one here. MVP put him in there with Bobby Lashley. I've said before that Lashley is just kind of eh for me. Doesn't really do much. But this was the first time in a long time that Lashley got my attention. If this was supposed to be a showcase for Kenny King, it was the opposite. It backfired because this was a showcase for Bobby Lashley. Guy that big, you know, being able to do a standing leapfrog with his back turned and not fuck it up, that's pretty impressive. The highlight of the show, let alone the match, came when Kenny King went up to the top rope. And it looked like he was going to do a blockbuster type move or a cannonball maybe. And as he's in midair flying, hurling his body and kind of flipping over a little bit towards Lashley, Lashley not only caught him in midair, he caught him in standing vertical suplex position and then held him there for about 5 or 6 seconds and dropped him. It was amazing. It was just an awesome spot, and naturally they showed no replay of it. After that, Kenny King bailed, got himself counted out. Just such a lame fucking finish to this match. I mean, I know getting yourself counted out and running away is a heel move. God knows how many fucking months in a row we saw that with Fandango on Raw back in the day. You know, it's a heel move. The problem is, we see so many heels, and not just in WWE, but even in TNA, we see so many heels getting themselves counted out these days. It doesn't work when everybody does it. It's such, like, it's a heel move, but when every single heel relies on it, it just gets watered down, and it's just such a lame finish. You know, plus they just reintroduced Kenny King, okay? The guy has been begging for a match. He finally gets one, and his first match is with Bobby Lashley, a guy who you know they're not going to beat. So how does that help Kenny King? Why would I care to see Kenny King wrestle Sonata or Tigre Uno now for the X Division title? What do I give a shit? All they're doing here is telling us that Kenny King sucks. But that's the match they're building towards. Is Kenny King meeting the winner of that best of three series? He's going to be the number one contender for the X title. Who cares? Put Bobby Lashley in there with Tigre Uno. I'd be more entertained. Actually, yeah, that could be a hell of a match. Mr. Anderson found Sam Shaw's childhood home. Lucky us. He rang the doorbell, and Shaw's mom answered the door, dressed like something out of the 1950s, like a Stepford wife. We learned that Sam Shaw's mother's name is Christy, and she invited Mr. Anderson to come inside. So I guess we're supposed to think that Sam Shaw has a mommy complex, and that's why he was so infatuated with Christy Hemme, because she shared a name with Sam's mom. Either that, or we're supposed to think that Sam Shaw has some sort of sick sexual attraction towards his mother. Which is some Sigmund Freud shit right there, and is most definitely something I would expect to be booked by Vince Russo. But anyway, back to this nonsense later. It gets better. Or worse, depending on your perspective. James Storm had a chat backstage with Bobby Roode. They both talked about the awful things they've done to each other over the years, which is weird, given that I remember watching an episode of Impact right before lockdown, where Bobby Roode was teasing his retirement. That was before Dixie promised him 10% of the company if, you know, he agreed to wrestle, you know, on Team Dixie, blah, blah, blah. And I remember, you know, there being an episode of Impact where these two guys kind of made amends backstage. They sat down, they had a very respectful, very nice conversation with each other. And, you know, all of a sudden, it's almost like that never happened. It's just, this is such a weird show. Anyway, they're partners tonight because together, this is what James Storm said, they were the greatest tag team of all time. That's what he said. Don't blame me. Tonight they take on Gunnar and Bully Ray. MVP beat Austin Aries in a pretty good match, stiff match. Aries nailed the running drop kick in the corner for a two count. Then he tried the 450 splash, but MVP moved out of the way, so Aries missed. MVP nailed the Shining Wizard, got the pin. I'm just glad to see Austin Aries back wrestling on the show, but I'm afraid to say that now because, you know, just watch them now. He'll go disappear again for 6 weeks. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if there's something up with Aries and TNA, but he's one of those guys that needs to be on the show way more often than he is. We got another great workout video with Seiya Sanada talking about how important the X Division title is to him and how it's his duty to live up to the expectations the great Muda has set for him. Such a weird thing because on the one hand, they gave this guy the title and they do these videos and they're awesome. They actually make the guy feel special. But then he wrestles and they give him like 4 minutes, which is never enough time to get over. You know, maybe at the pay-per-view, he and Tigre Uno, they're going to have their final match, I think, in their best of three. Maybe they'll go out there on the pay-per-view, give him 15 minutes, 12 minutes, something like that, and they'll tear the house down. You know, but just the booking of this guy has been so weird to me. I want to compliment them. I want to say, wow, they've done a great job with this guy. But he's going to sell himself out there in the ring, and when you get 3 or 4 minutes, you can't really do that. So I don't really think it's working. We got more wackiness from Casa de Shaw. Anderson was in his mom's kitchen. She said, "I bake my son an apple pie every day." And Anderson said, "Wow, you deliver that to him every day?" And Sam's mom said, "Of course, he lives right downstairs in the basement." Now, I want to stop here, okay? Let's pause here for a moment. Remember those early vignettes with Sam Shaw and Christy Hemme where he took her out to dinner and yeah, she stepped away to go to the ladies' room, and he got all angry at the waiter, grabbed the guy's hand because he thought the waiter was making a pass at her. And that's when we started to see those character traits come through, and we realized the guy's not all there. He's too possessive and that kind of stuff. Well, you know, I'm pretty sure the very next segment we saw on the next episode of Impact was Sam Shaw taking Christy back to his apartment and showing her around. But remember, he kept her away from that room with the giant shrine. He built this whole shrine, all with photos of Christy Hemme, and there may have been a mannequin in there, I don't remember. And he kept her away from that room because he didn't want her to see it, even though she found out about it later on. Okay, if he lives in his mother's basement, then whose place was that? I mean, what, does he rent an apartment somewhere else to murder the women that he brings there and keep the bodies, and then he goes back home to his mom's basement so he can get his daily fix of apple pie? You know, working for TNA, it's not a stretch to think that the guy can't afford his own place and he has to live in his mom's basement. I can actually believe that. So it looks like they forgot their own angle. It's just one of those stupid little inconsistencies that annoys me. Anyway, Anderson went downstairs. He wanted to see Sam's bedroom, which was made up to look like the bedroom of any 5-year-old in America. There was a bunk bed. There was a colorful sign on the wall that said Samuel's room. In walks Sam Shaw, who wanted to know what the hell Ken Anderson was doing in his bedroom, which is a valid question. That would probably be my first response, too. Things broke out into a brawl. The cameraman, apparently frightened for his life, grabbed the camera, made a run for it upstairs. They shot this like a horror movie, you know, like with the shaky cam and everything. He's just running up the stairs, running for his life, trying to get out of there. And he goes upstairs. And actually, in fairness, half the time that's what TNA is, a horror movie, so kind of makes sense. Cameraman stumbles into Shaw's mom, who offers him some pie. Apple pie, that is. I should probably clarify that. And Sam Shaw then comes upstairs. He's all bloody, his nose is bloody, and he hugs his mother, and the cameraman runs away. And the two men are going to have a loser gets committed to an insane asylum match at Sacrifice tonight. I think whoever came up with this storyline should be committed right along with them. And throw Willow in there too while you're at it. Commit half the fucking company, since mental illness apparently is running rampant in Impact Wrestling. Beer Money, James Storm and Bobby Roode beat Gunner and Bully Ray. Good tag team match. I probably enjoyed this match even better than the MVP Aries match, but they were both good. Ray had Bobby Roode laid out across a table on the outside. He climbed up onto the apron, came off with an elbow that missed. So Ray crashed through the table. Back in the ring, Gunner had Storm beat with a DDT. Bobby Roode broke it up. He got Gunnar up for his move, but or actually, I should say Gunnar got Bobby Roode up for his move. But James Storm hit the last call super kick. Picture perfect. Just clobbered this guy right in the chin with the super kick and got the pin. Remember last week when I asked what happened to those weird segments with Nux? They started doing this thing like weeks ago where it was Nux. Who the last time we saw Nux, he was with Aces and Eights trying to cause the destruction of TNA. All of a sudden, we're supposed to care about the guy. And he's in a car, like, driving back home where he came from. There was, like, a big hurricane or a big storm that came and flooded out his hometown. So he was going back home to survey the damage and make sure everything was okay and see his family. And we got, like, two segments. And he got reacquainted with this woman who I don't think they ever said, but if it was his sister, or I think it was his girlfriend. Okay? And there was some drama. They had, like, dramatic dialogue between you, like, yeah, you know, where have you been? Your family's been here struggling. And he's like, well, I had to go chase my dreams. And, you know, I had to go grab a tissue. It was so emotional. But they did these segments, and then they never spoke of them again. It's kind of like they fell off the face of the earth. And I asked last week, you know, what's up with this? Well, this week we had our first Nux segment in a while. It was him back home at a bar, hanging out with his friends and his girlfriend. I'm going to assume that they're boyfriend-girlfriend, or they were. So Nux told her, you know, I got to leave again, and I have to follow my dreams. I have to go back to Impact Wrestling. When I hear somebody say they have to follow their dreams, I have to go back to Impact Wrestling are not the words that I expect to follow that sentence. And his girlfriend then tells him, you know, I lost you once. I'm not going to lose you again. I'm going with you. And Nux was so happy. At least until he comes back with this chick in his corner and then she turns on him a month later, which you know is going to happen, okay? You heard it here first. If she's going to be on camera with him in his corner managing him in a month, they're going to break up. She's going to turn on him. You know, that's just how it is. That's just how things are in TNA. You can't trust anybody. But this whole thing is just very weird. You know, the last segment we saw, Nux was going to go confront his old man. He was asking her, you know, how's the old man doing? He's like, well, why don't you go find out yourself? And it was like they were building up to this big dramatic moment where Nux was going to go see his father for the first time in years, and then it was never even brought up here. It was never mentioned. They can't keep these stories straight. Like, if you're going to do it, commit to it. You know, stick to it. Don't, it's like, oh, God, it drives me mad that they do stuff like this, but I guess Nux is coming back, and why Impact would welcome this guy back after he beat people up with hammers and he... Yeah, again, he tried to cause the destruction of the company. Well, I guess Hulk Hogan did too, and I'm sure they would welcome Hogan back with open arms, so why not Nux? Abyss did a backstage promo admitting that he made a mistake in aligning with Magnus and hurting the people who cared about him the most. He singled out one person in particular, but never mentioned Eric Young by name. He said, tonight, this match was for him. So how long before they reunite as buddies and then Abyss turns on Eric Young? Want to take bets? I'm not a betting man, but I'm willing to bet that that's where this is going. That's how they do things. They want to swerve you. Main event was a terrible match between Magnus and Abyss, which had Eric Young on commentary. He said nothing. Great finish to this horrible match, too, with Magnus kicking Abyss in the crotch for the DQ. That's great. Magnus then grabbed the chair, started clobbering Abyss with it before EY ran down for the save. He got hit with the chair as well a few times. They went off the air, not with an ad for tonight's pay-per-view. They went off the air hyping up next week's Impact. And I ask again, why bother even having pay-per-views if you're not going to promote them? Why? I mean, just why? What is there a good reason for having Sacrifice as a pay-per-view instead of, let's say, a Spike TV special? You know, they would have like an episode of Impact that would be promoted as a pay-per-view. It seems to me like Impact this week should be a special edition of Impact called Sacrifice instead of trying to charge people $50 to watch this bullshit on pay-per-view. Why even have pay-per-views? It just doesn't make any sense to me. TNA's contracted with a talent agency now. There was a press release they put out this week. They've contracted with the UTA agency to negotiate things like their TV deal for them. So they must not be too confident about staying on Spike. You know, we'll know in the next couple of weeks if WWE is headed there or not. I still think that they're staying on USA. But if they do come back to Spike, then TNA is done. So I would imagine you're going to have some very nervous people there until WWE makes their announcement. If I'm TNA, I'd be embarrassed to air that Sam Shaw, Mr. Anderson stuff while I'm still waiting to find out if the network that I air on wants to keep us or not. If that were me, if I were Spike, I would drop them for that crap alone. I'd drop them like a bad habit. I'd put a marathon of Cops on for 3 hours every Thursday night instead of that Sam Shaw, Mr. Anderson bullshit. And from Sam Shaw, Mr. Anderson, we go to the Ring of Honor lineup. I want to just run through the lineup really quick for the Ring of Honor New Japan show, War of the Worlds, coming up on May 17th. Sold out Hammerstein Ballroom, New York City. They could sell out the Hammerstein, and TNA is going to try to sell out the Grand Ballroom, which is smaller, upstairs in the same building in June. We'll see if they could pull that one off. But yeah, we go from that to an actual wrestling show here that I'm looking forward to a lot. I got my ticket. I'm ready to go. Be my first Ring of Honor show since last year. When did I go to Ring of Honor last? I think it was when Jay Briscoe won the title WrestleMania weekend last year. Might have been the last one I went to. But anyway, the lineup has been released, and it will be the Ring of Honor champion Adam Cole against Jushin Liger. Liger is 50 years old this year, which is pretty amazing. IWGP champion Kazuchika Okada defending against Michael Elgin. Now, the champions right now are Cole and Okada. That could change, because I think both titles will be defended between now and then, obviously. So if the titles change, I guess it'll be whoever the champion is against Liger and whoever the champion is against Elgin. And it would not shock me if AJ Styles could become the new IWGP champion before then, because I think he's got a title shot, I want to say the beginning of May, coming up in the next week or so. So it is possible that title could change hands beforehand. But anyway, Ring of Honor tag team titles on the line. The Young Bucks defend against Red Dragon. IWGP tag team champions Carl Anderson and Luke Gallows against the Briscoes. TV champion Jay Lethal against Kushida. Shinsuke Nakamura against Kevin Steen. And Hiroshi Tanahashi against Michael Bennett, which is an interesting match. Also appearing on the show will be AJ Styles, Jado and Gato, The Decade, which is comprised of Roderick Strong, BJ Whitmer, and Jimmy Jacobs, and more. So I am looking forward to this show big time. I've never seen the New Japan. I mean, I have seen Carl Anderson before, but a lot of the New Japan guys I've never seen live. I've seen some of the iPay-per-views. I actually do enjoy their stuff. And Ring of Honor, like I said, it's been a while since I've been to a show. Last one, I think, was when Jay Briscoe won the belt, which was a cool moment, and this is going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to this show. It sold out pretty quickly. There was a lot of demand for tickets. There may still be some tickets available, because when they did the whole configuration for the building and production and all that, I think in the last week or two, they may have opened up some more tickets. So if you wanted to go to the show, if you look into it right now and don't waste any time, you might actually be able to get a ticket to the show, unless they're all sold out again, I'm not sure. But that might be something for you if you live in the New York area, you want to go, you might still have a chance. Let's break into the mailbag here since we're running low on time here. Please send your emails to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com and include your name and where you are from when you write in. You could also send in MP3 questions as attachments. Try to keep it to about 30 seconds or so and put the text of your question in the body of the email. Some of you still don't do that, and there's a pretty good chance I won't use your question if you don't do that. So you can send those questions to me there. This question comes from Brian. I was watching the Warrior Ultimate Legacy documentary recently and noticed that 34 minutes in, they showed an old flyer for a WWE event from July 25th, 1996 at the Cal Palace. On the flyer, it listed Intercontinental Champion Ahmed Johnson defending against Goldust, Undertaker against Mankind, and a special attraction match of British Bulldog against Psycho Sid. But the strange part was the main event. It was the Ultimate Warrior defending the WWF title against Vader. How is this possible? Was it just a misprint? And if so, why put it in the documentary? At the time, Shawn Michaels was the champ, and from what I've read, he was supposed to be the champion at least until SummerSlam the next month. Was Warrior ever scheduled to win the title in 1996? I don't think he was. And that sounds like the same stunt they pulled on the Self-Destruction DVD. I don't think there ever was a Warrior vs. Vader title match planned for that show, or any show that summer. I know on the Self-Destruction DVD, they were trying to illustrate how they had Warrior booked for these really important dates that he no-showed, and they showed that poster on the DVD. But my understanding is that they just created a fake poster to include on the DVD just to try to make their point and make Warrior look bad, which was the whole point of the self-destruction DVD. The timeline doesn't even make any sense. There's no way that Warrior was supposed to be the champion in July. There's no way. I just don't see it. I've never heard anybody talk about that in interviews or anything. I know Jim Cornette always said the plan was to put the title on Vader. I think originally it was going to be at SummerSlam, but Shawn Michaels got that changed. Then Vader was going to win it from him at Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden that year. But after Shawn threw his little hissy fit at SummerSlam, I guess he didn't want to drop it to Vader. So Sid, who they brought back after Warrior left, he ended up getting the title instead. But the idea of Warrior beating Shawn Michaels for the title at the July In Your House pay-per-view or on a Monday Night Raw or something like that, because where else would it have happened? That's why I say the timeline just doesn't make any sense, that Warrior would be defending the title against Vader in matches at house shows in July. It just makes absolutely no sense. And nor do I think they would have taken the title from Shawn until at least SummerSlam. I think they were at least going to give him until then to run with the belt. So it was likely a phony poster that never really existed. They mocked it up to suit their own agenda. They photoshopped it, whatever. I didn't even notice it on the network documentary, so I may have missed it, but that sounds like the same poster they had on the DVD. Bryant Guzman in Ozone Park, New York. I keep watching the Divas matches thinking of all the untapped potential they have if given the time. AJ Lee versus Natalya on main event is an example of how good a Divas match can be. Why do you think WWE cannot give the Divas a proper story to follow and the confidence to give them the time to have a good match like you would see on NXT or on main event? Well, that's the million-dollar question, my friend. I don't have a good answer for you. I watched that AJ Natalya match, and I was blown away by how good it was. I knew they would give them more time, because generally on main event, you get more than 3 or 4 minutes for your match, since I think on main event they only have two matches. Either main event or superstars. One of them, the draw for one of them is that you get two exclusive matches every week. I think it's main event. But they went out there, they had an awesome match. They had easily the best Divas match of the year so far. And you're right, there really is no reason on a three-hour Raw show. Okay, you want to say, well, SmackDown's 2 hours and we have to fit this in and fit that in. Well, what's your excuse on Monday night when you've got 3 hours to kill? You really can't find time to give two Divas who can actually go the chance to go out there for 10, 12 minutes. I'll give TNA credit on this issue here. In the past, when they've had really good knockouts matches, when you have like Gail Kim in there with somebody reasonably good, let's say, okay, and maybe the beautiful people don't qualify for that, but they would give them 10, 12 minutes. I saw plenty of Gail Kim and Mickie James matches who went, you know, that went 10, 12 minutes on Impact. And Impact's a two-hour show. How come TNA can do it and WWE can't? You know, there's no reason for it. So for all of us who are just waiting, oh, I can't wait until they bring up Paige, I can't wait until they bring up Emma, you always hope for that, but then you kind of, it's a double-edged sword there, because as great as they are at NXT and they give them time and all that kind of stuff, you know, Emma comes up and now she's wearing, you know, pink sock puppets with Santino, and Paige comes up and, you know, Paige is doing well so far. Can't really complain about Paige, but you worry. Because it's almost like coming up to the main roster could be a detriment in a way. Like, if you just want to go out there and have a long match and have a really great match, I don't know that Raw and SmackDown, or maybe Raw, I shouldn't say SmackDown, I don't know that Raw is really the place for that. And Raw's the A show. So the women, you know, they're kind of caught in the middle here. But believe me, if they wanted to give them more time, they could. They could do whatever they want. It's their show. Just give them more time. We had two Divas matches this week instead of one. So the combined total of Divas ring time on Monday night was like 6.5 minutes, I think, or maybe seven minutes. I would rather have one really good long 10-minute or 12-minute match than have two matches, one that's 2 minutes, the other that's 4 minutes, and they're dead, and they kind of rush through it, and nobody cares. But that's just me. This comes from Jay. Where do you think each member of the Shield will be 5 years from now, and can Dean Ambrose reach his full character potential under PG? What is this this titty master bullshit I keep seeing? This must be like way over my head here. I know Ambrose, maybe back in his Moxley days, was like a ladies' man and all that kind of stuff. And supposedly he's dating Renee Young now. I'm not sure how true that is. I've seen pictures of them together, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But where is this titty master BS coming from? What does that even mean? Maybe somebody can help me out here. Or maybe I don't want to know what the Titty Master is. I have no idea. Oh, my God. Can he reach his full potential under PG? Of course he can. Anybody can reach their full character potential under PG if they're book right and if they go out there and they're... Look, I'll give you an example, okay? Seinfeld. Okay, one of the best sitcoms, if not the best sitcom of all time, Seinfeld. Coming up on the 25th anniversary this year. So Seinfeld is on the air, and I've heard Larry David talk about this before. He wanted to do an episode about masturbation, one of the most classic Seinfeld episodes out there, The Master of Your Domain. Okay, I'm sure if you're a Seinfeld fan, you know all about this. And the thing is, they couldn't say the word masturbation. They couldn't say whack off, jerk off, masturbate. Like, they couldn't say it because standards and practices back then were such that they could allude to it, but they couldn't actually outright say it. And so what that meant was they had to be creative with how they were going to do an episode that was about masturbation. So they came up with all these puns and these expressions, and again, the whole master of your own domain kind of thing. It was so clever that I don't think the episode would have worked as well had they just had them come out and say outright what it was, that, hey, we're going to have this contest to see who can go the longest without masturbating. But because they had to be creative with it and come up with every way except outright saying it, it made the episode better. So to me, when people say, well, it's PG, so this guy can't be as good, and this guy can't curse, and this guy can't do that. You know what? Would I love it if Roman Reigns could come out one week all pissed off as part of a Shield promo and look Triple H in the eye and say, I'm going to make you my bitch tonight? Or say something that would really pop the crowd and make the crowd go, oh, holy shit, and then chant Roman Reigns. And like, that would be awesome. But you know what? For the people who think that these guys, they can't get over the same, it's hurting them, that's complete bullshit. Because if you can't get over, you know, with a PG product, then guess what? You're not good enough to get over. If your whole existence is based on your ability to be able to go out there and drop an S-bomb or use foul language or use sexual innuendos and all this kind of stuff to get over, and you can't do it because it's PG, then guess what? You're not good enough. I think Dean Ambrose is good enough. I think he'll be fine without doing some of the stuff he did back when he was Jon Moxley. I mean, he's got to tone it down a little bit. Everybody's got to tone it down, man. He's got the same handicaps that every single person on that roster does. Every single person has to abide by the same rules. Nobody's going to go out there and say bullshit or drop an F-bomb or use the word asshole like they used to be able to do back in the day. It's a level, even playing field. Ambrose has the same handicaps that every other person from John Cena all the way down to Zack Ryder has on that roster. And if he's not clever enough and creative enough to come up with PG dialogue to replace what he probably would like to say, then he's not good enough. But I think Ambrose will be just fine. I just wanted to mention that because there are people who think PG is hurting guys because it's not allowing them to reach their full potential. It's not allowing them to probably do certain things and use words that they would otherwise use, but they'll just come up with another way because they're good enough to do that. And if they're not, they won't last very long. Stop using PG as a crutch. And now I got to go back to Jay's original question, which I think I completely overlooked here. He wanted to know, where do you think each member of the Shield will be in 5 years? I think they're going to be, if not in main event positions, upper mid-card, you know, main event guys, because they're all that good. I think Roman Reigns is going to be their next big golden boy. He may probably ascend to the top quicker than the other two will, but it would be a crime if Seth Rollins, especially, I mean, Rollins and Ambrose, but especially Rollins. Rollins, I think, was kind of the guy that was left out of the conversation for a long time. It was all about Roman Reigns. He looks the part. He's big. He's strong. And everyone's, well, Ambrose is going to be just fine because Ambrose is great. And, you know, Rollins kind of got the shaft in a lot of those conversations. And I think what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 months, especially, is that Seth Rollins has opened up a lot of eyes. And he's the one who goes out there and talks about being the architect of the Shield, kind of the glue that keeps the operation together. He, you know, he'll literally throw himself all over the place, you know, for the sake of the match. I mean, he just is incredible as a performer, and the babyface fire that he shows. I always said that. I mean, go back and listen to any of the old Sound Off episodes. I always said that I thought the real future and the real money for these guys was in Roman Reigns as a big baby face, Dean Ambrose as like this ultra villain, similar to the way Brian Pillman used to be, this loose cannon type of character, and Seth Rollins as a baby face. Because that's what he was on NXT, and he was, you know, he had a big fan following, the women loved him and all that kind of stuff. But, and maybe, you know what, to kind of connect this back to an NXT example, I was talking about Corey Graves earlier. I don't look at Corey Graves quite on the same level as Seth Rollins. I put Seth Rollins up here and Corey Graves kind of down here. But I said, you know, maybe one of the problems with Graves and why I can't get into him and he's so boring to me besides his, you know, his leg-based offense is that he's better as a babyface. Some guys are just better taking a beating and taking a beating and making that big, fiery babyface comeback. And I think that's one of the big selling points for Seth Rollins. So I always thought that his future was as a hero and not a villain. And I still feel that way. And I could see him being a world champion down the road. I could see Roman Reigns. In fact, I can guarantee that Roman Reigns at some point will be a world champion, probably many times over. Dean Ambrose can be a world champion too. I don't know if he'll have that opportunity before Rollins, or if Rollins will have that chance before Ambrose. It's a coin toss on that one. I don't know. But they're going to do just fine. You know, as long as they keep their nose clean and they stay, you know, injury-free, they're going to be fine. They're all going to be big stars. I think this company is going to be built around those guys going forward. Those guys and the Wyatts, you know, Bray Wyatt in particular, Luke Harper, this is going to be the glue that keeps the company together 5-10 years down the road. Bill from Ohio. With CM Punk not returning for WrestleMania 30 and AJ Lee on hiatus, do you think there's a possibility that Jeff Jarrett could be pulling off the biggest coup since Hall and Nash left WWE for WCW? Do you think Punk and AJ could ultimately be headed for Global Force Wrestling? And if so, what impact would it have on the industry? Well, I don't have to answer the second part of your question because the answer is no. And I'm not privy to any inside information or anything like that, but I'll go out on a limb and guarantee you the answer is no. I do not see Punk and AJ popping up in Global Force Wrestling. And if they did, would it make an impact? Sure. And that could be very attractive to a network, too, if they could show some TV executives, hey, listen, we've got these named people from, you know, WWE that we now have signed into the fold, and, you know, we're serious about this. We've got some big-name talent. It could be very helpful to them, but not going to happen. Our boy Wiza sent this in. Lately, I've been listening to Jim Ross's Ross Report podcast. I notice he's very passionate about time limits and how they can build intrigue and story to mid-card titles. Time limits and draws greatly helped heels get extra heat in the territory days and in WCW. They also make 60-minute Ironman matches feel like a big deal. What are your thoughts on time limits for mid-card titles, and can it possibly work in today's age of sports entertainment? I think WWE, as big of a machine as they are, can make anything work when it comes to stuff like that. They can make you believe that the Intercontinental title is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and that these guys would die. They would sacrifice their lives to be the Intercontinental champion if they wanted that title to mean something, but they don't. If they wanted time limits to mean something, they could get them to mean something. It would take a while. It would be an education process that would take a while, but yeah, I do. I think it could happen, and I like time limits. I think when they're used, I mean, I wouldn't want to see a time limit draw on TV every single week. I know WCW used to do that gimmick with their TV title. It had like 10-minute time limits, and so, you know, you'd have the heel who looked like he was in jeopardy of losing the title, and then the bell would ring, and it would be frustrating as a fan to watch that, but it would be great heat on the heel, so yeah, I mean, it worked before, and a lot of stuff that worked in the old school can work now. Some people don't want to consider that, oh, it's old. That's old school way of thinking, but a lot of that old school stuff worked because it made sense, and it could work now just as easily. I guess the issue there is if all of a sudden you started announcing in advance, hey, this mid-card match has a 15-minute time limit or a 10-minute time limit, it would kind of give it away to the fans, like, oh, all of a sudden they're announcing time limits, so gee, I wonder, you know, if this match is going to go to a time limit draw. So I think the way around that is you start having the ring announcer announce time limits, and you'd probably have to have the announcers or the general manager or somebody address that on TV, like, why all of a sudden are time limits being instituted? You'd have to explain that. But you know, you could probably get around the obviousness of it by just announcing time limits and not having a time limit draw for a while. So just start doing it now, get going on that, make people aware of the fact, okay, these matches will have time limits, and then at some point, when there's a really big dramatic finish coming up, you can have the time expire, and yeah, I do think it could be very effective. I would agree with JR on that. David from Melbourne, Australia, I was just looking at the Wrestling Observer Awards and saw so many awards for Japanese wrestlers, including best promotion, matches, wrestlers, and feuds. I've watched some Japanese wrestling through the years. It's very slow and similar to MMA, and the crowd is very silent, although I know that's kind of a sign of respect. Just wanted to know your opinion on Japanese wrestling, and do you think those awards make sense? I mean, I know Meltzer does the awards because he's, you know, he's not just considering North America. He's counting all over the world. So, you know, the Mexican promotions are in there as well, CMLL, AAA. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense for them to be in there. My thoughts on Japanese wrestling is I've never been able to follow it closely because I just don't make the extra effort to, you know, back then it would be like search for tapes, and now it's a lot easier, I would imagine, in that you can go on Daily Motion or YouTube. There is some Japanese wrestling that's uploaded, but if I wanted to keep track, let's say, of New Japan week to week, I don't really have that ability. I can't do that. You know, New Japan is not on TV here. I can get the iPay-per-views on occasion when they have them, but not all of their events are on iPay-per-view. And even, you know, the New Japan events on iPay-per-view is still a relatively recent phenomenon. There's just no easy way for me to watch their product consistently week to week. So I just can never get into it. But when I do watch it, because I've had, you know, I've been able to watch events online, and there have been some iPay-per-views that I've actually paid for, and they're long, they're very long, the shows, but there's a lot of good wrestling on there. And they have interesting characters. It's not just like it's straight, boring wrestling. You've got a lot of characters that would probably work very well working for Vince McMahon. Even out there in Japan, if anything, some of the characters out there in Japan are even more far out than you would find here in the States. Unless you're talking about a promotion like a Chikara or something like that. I like Japanese wrestling, not enough that I follow it consistently to know all the different stories, but I know a lot of the names, and I've paid closer attention to it, I think, in the last year and a half. You know, I said before, I'm looking forward to the Ring of Honor New Japan show next month. And I am, like, legit. I'm looking forward to it a lot, actually. That'll be my first time seeing a lot of those guys live and in person. The style is just different. You talked about the fans and how they're very silent. It's always been that way in Japanese wrestling. I mean, for years and years and years, you could hear stories of guys even like Hogan and guys like that who used to work in Japan quite a bit, and they would explain that it's just the culture is different in terms, like the wrestling culture over there is just very different. They're not going to start a wave. They're not going to start chanting for the announcers. Okay, you're not going to see stuff like that. When there's a high spot or there's a near fall, they will react. And a lot of times they'll react very big and they'll applaud and they'll clap. And it just takes some getting used to. It doesn't mean that they're not into the match. It doesn't mean they think the match is boring. It's just a completely different style. It's a more respectful style of wrestling. It's just how it is. The Japanese fans, generally speaking, are more respectful than the fans you would find at a WWE show or at a TNA show or whatever North American show. It's just how it is. I like it. I don't like it enough where I watch it every week. I'm going to go through hell or high water and search all over the world to make sure I can watch my New Japan every single week. But I do like it. Daniel writes in, what did WWE do with the Shield that they did not do with the Nexus? What key factors made them more popular than the Nexus? Everything. Everything they did. It's just incredible to me to think back to the heat that the Nexus had when they first hit the scene. That big angle they did on Raw where they attacked John Cena, they tore up the ring. I mean, there were a lot of people who said, this is just like the NWO in 96 when they invaded. This is like a modern-day version of the NWO. This is going to be so cool. This is going to be so awesome. And it was for a while. They would come out. They would beat people up. Not unlike the Shield. They would beat up the Legends. Unfortunately, they beat up Ricky Steamboat a little too much. And that was not good. But it was going well for a while. And then came SummerSlam and the big 10-man tag, which John Cena won, And even after the fact, Cena admitted he made a mistake going over in that match. That was the story that Jericho, or I think it was Edge, told that story on Jericho's podcast. That's how John Cena felt after the fact. He realized it was probably a mistake for that match to go that way. And they tried to salvage it. The Nexus didn't go away right away. They even had Wade Barrett beat John Cena's singles match. Cena became the Nexus slave. It was over at that point. It was done. It was finished. They missed the boat. And with the Shield, the biggest difference of all is from day one, when the Shield came in, the Shield were booked as serious threats to the roster. They were never beaten. They always, or almost always, had the upper hand. It was a long, long, long time before the Shield lost their first match, and I still remember what that match was. It was on an episode of SmackDown last, maybe May, I don't remember the exact month, but I remember the episode of SmackDown when the Shield lost. It was a six-man tag. I want to say it was against Bryan and Orton and maybe Kane. I don't really remember, but they made a big deal about it. The fans were going crazy. The announcers made a point to mention it. You know, if you build something up long enough and you protect guys the way they should be protected and you don't beat them like a drum and you don't make them look like fools, it's amazing how guys can get over. Reigns, Rollins, and Ambrose from day one have been protected. Now, there was a period of time when they first lost. They went on and they lost a little too much, I thought. It was like, okay, now that they lost, we can just beat them every week. And that I didn't agree with that. But that aside, for the most part, the Shield has been booked better than any other trio in the history of WWE. The Shield has been booked better than any other new guys that have been brought up to the main roster, I think, at any point in the history of that company. It's unbelievable to me, as many other careers as they've ruined, as many other start-and-stop pushes as guys have had, be it Ziggler or whoever, that these guys have somehow managed to avoid all of that, and they, for the most part, like 95%, have been booked perfectly. And look at them now. They're huge stars. They've been around now for a long time, well over a year, year and a half, and these guys are in the same position in that everybody looks at them and knows these are main eventers. These are future main eventers. Roman Reigns is going to be a main eventer. Seth Rollins can be a main eventer. Dean Ambrose can be a main eventer. Nobody's looking at these guys as damaged goods, like they did pretty much every member of the Nexus, I think, when that angle was over. And even Barrett. Barrett hasn't quite recovered since then either. Only now is he finally starting to find his footing, and maybe they're finally taking this Bad News Barrett character in a direction where he might actually get over. And it only took him finally getting in the ring and wrestling for that to happen. How many fucking months did I crow on my podcast? Please, put this guy in the ring. Let him wrestle. Let him do, you know, let him show what he's got and kick some ass, and maybe he'll actually get over. It wasn't that I hated the Bad News gimmick. He did it on the JBL and Cole show and was very entertaining with it. It was just that he would come out every single week, and he would do comedy, scripted comedy that wasn't fucking funny. And he was not getting in the ring and backing it up, and it was just going nowhere. Only when they put him in the ring, finally, is he now starting to get over. But for a long time, Wade Barrett was just this lost soul on the main roster, and they did nothing with him. They put the Intercontinental title on him, and it made matters worse. Which is why, if I'm Barrett, I should be a little bit worried if I end up winning this tournament and beating Big E at the pay-per-view like I think he will. But the point is, they protected the Shield. They protected the Shield more than any other guys I can ever remember them promoting up. And you see the end result here. You see what happened to the Nexus. They didn't last very long. And you see the Shield is still around. The Shield is not only still around, but they were clearly building to a breakup of the Shield, like, by WrestleMania. I have no doubt the plan was to break up the Shield by WrestleMania. But they got over so huge, especially in that feud with the Wyatts, and the fans started turning in their favor, and they became big baby faces, where it just became obvious, why the hell are we going to break these guys up now? Let's just run with this. Let's run with the momentum they have. And, you know, even if it's just another 3 months, 6 months, maybe they go another year before they break these guys up. You didn't have that with the Nexus. You had a lot of people shaking their heads. You don't have that with the Shield. That's the difference between protecting guys and not protecting them. This comes from William. Do you think WWE should turn the Slammys into an actual award show and not just a joke on a random episode of Raw? The Slammys could air on the WWE Network the day before SummerSlam and could be to SummerSlam what the Hall of Fame is to WrestleMania. It makes sense, since SummerSlam is always in LA. to do an award-type show, and they would probably be able to get a bunch of celebrities to make appearances. It could be a night to legitimately honor the things that these superstars do throughout the year. That is a hell of an idea, tying it in with SummerSlam. I've advocated that the Slammy should be their own standalone award show on this podcast before. You know, they could do it like they did back in the 80s and the 90s, where it was at like an actual, like a banquet hall. It was like an actual award show. Or they could do it in an arena, you know, either way. I think when they resurrected the Slammies a few years ago, they did it as a gimmick for when they did those three-hour Raw shows when they were special attractions. Now that Raw is 3 hours every single week, I agree with William. You break it off as its own, let's say, one-hour special on the network, because you want to have as much live content unique to the network as possible. It's like, if I'm sitting there, I'm thinking to myself, all right, we have our bi-monthly NXT specials, and we have our documentaries and stuff like that, and we have our Raw pre- and post-game shows, but like, what else? What other live content can we possibly put on the network besides Main Event that would be, you know, a draw that people would want to see, and maybe they would subscribe because, hey, I can only see this on the network. The Slammies would be just something else they could offer. Why not do a Slammy show? And I hadn't even thought of the L.A. tie-in with SummerSlam and celebrities and all that. They could do a red carpet deal like they did for the Hall of Fame. They had Michael Cole hosting it with Maria Menounos. You know, they could, hey, look, it's the stars from Total Divas. Here they come. Or, hey, it's the cast from Legends House. I think that makes a lot of sense. You could even dedicate Slammy categories to the best moment from the most recent season of Total Divas or Legends House. You can still have the fans vote on Match of the Year, Superstar of the Year, Shocker of the Year, Biggest Upset, Best Debut, that sort of thing. I'd probably have a category dedicated to NXT, too. So I support that. Two thumbs up. Finally here, Jack from Rugby England. I was just listening to a video on the WWE YouTube channel, and it made me think, if Kurt Angle was still in his prime in WWE, who would you like to see him wrestle? Personally, I think Cesaro and Angle would be a great match. Wow. Well, Cesaro and Angle would be a fucking awesome match. I think you're actually understating it. Cesaro probably would be my first choice if we're thinking of guys from the current roster. I mean, we could think of guys from like the last 10, 12 years. I think the big match, Kurt Angle and Bret Hart in his prime. I'm talking like Bret back in like 93, 94. Would have been unbelievable. But the two guys from the current roster that I think against Kurt Angle in his prime would be phenomenal matches. Cesaro is one, Daniel Bryan's the other. Bryan's a wrestling machine, Kurt's a wrestling machine. You put those two guys in there, you just take the gloves off, say, go out there, you got 15 minutes, 20 minutes, have at it. I mean, they would just tear the house down. I have no doubt about that. They'd probably have one of the best matches in company history. So it's a shame we won't get to see that. It's all just kind of a fantasy warfare at this point. But, you know, I have to say, at least we did get to see Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels. Those two, that was like a dream match going in, and they did not disappoint. They had, I think they had three matches, none of which I thought were as good as the first one. The first one was WrestleMania 21, and you knew that was an awesome match when Bobby Heenan at the time actually said that was the greatest wrestling match he had ever seen. And Heenan's one of those guys, you know, he's a legend of the business who's been around since the 60s. He's managed like everybody there is to manage. He's worked all over the place, AWA, WWE, WCW. For him to make a comment like that back then in 05 and watch that and say, that was the best wrestling match I've ever seen, is pretty high praise. So at least we got to see that. We got to see Kurt in there with a lot of really talented people, not just Shawn Michaels. He was in there with Brock. He was in there with Benoit. He was in there with, I'm trying to think who else he was in there with that really stood out to me. Rey Mysterio. I remember their first match at SummerSlam back in 02 when Kurt was dressed up like the Ice Cream Man. Kurt and even Kurt and The Undertaker, you know, they had a... I've talked about this match as being somewhat underrated because it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. It wasn't at a big pay-per-view like a WrestleMania. Had it been at WrestleMania 22, I think it would be remembered a lot more. But Undertaker and Kurt had a match before WrestleMania that year at No Way Out, No 6, for the world title. That was just unbelievable. So Kurt got to work with a lot of different guys. I think Kurt Angle's going to be one of those guys when all is said and done, and he'll be in the Hall of Fame one day. He deserves to be in the Hall of Fame one day, but he will go down, I think, as one of the greatest. And when I say one of the greatest, I'm talking like top five in terms of in-ring wrestlers in company history. I mean, that's the kind of class I think that you have to put Kurt Angle in. And I think in some circles, he's underrated. believe it or not. I would say Kurt Angle, if anything, is underrated as a performer, not overrated. Because I don't get the sense that people think of Kurt, they don't put him in the same breath as guys like Michaels and Brett and Austin and Rock. I mean, Kurt wasn't as big of a star as those guys. He didn't make as much money as a guy like a Hogan or an Austin. But if we're just going to talk like pure wrestlers that have worked in WWE on the big stage like that, Kurt's got to be way up there at the top, man. He's got to be, if not top three, certainly top five. I just don't get the sense he gets the kind of love that he probably should get. And who knows? Maybe part of that is that he went to TNA, and he's been in TNA now for longer than he was in WWE. Maybe that works against him. I don't know. There have been guys that have come from WWE to TNA, spend a few years, and end up back there. That hasn't happened yet with Kurt. Kurt may yet leave TNA later this year. He may end up back in WWE in some position. But he's been there for so long that maybe some people just don't look at him the same way. They think it's such a huge step down that it kind of killed his legacy a little bit. I don't know what the rationale is there, but I think Kurt doesn't get the kind of respect that he probably deserves.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, it was 24 years ago this week on April 23rd, 1990. Mr. Perfect beat Tito Santana in the finals of a tournament to crown a new Intercontinental Champion after the Ultimate Warrior was forced to vacate the title following his win over Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 6. Oddly enough, when you go back and watch Hennig and Heenan celebrating their victory, Perfect is holding up the WWF Tag Team title belt. They did that with Ric Flair when he had to stop wearing the big gold NWA belt on TV, and they started video distorting it when he would come to the ring. They did that because he wasn't actually wearing the big gold belt anymore since he sent that back. They gave him a tag belt to wear, which was actually very easy to see. They didn't do a terribly good job of video distorting it. It would basically be like a dot sometimes they would put over it, but as he moved around, you can kind of tell it was a tag team belt. And maybe they had an extra one they kept on standby for certain situations. 22 years ago this week, on April 25th, 1992, the very first ECW champion was crowned. Back then, it was Eastern Championship Wrestling. They held two separate battle royals, one of which was won by Salvatore Bellomo, the other by Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Snuka beat Bellomo to become the first ECW champ. 19 years ago this week, on April 26th, 1995, at a WWE TV taping in Moline, Illinois, Triple H made his in-ring debut as Hunter Hearst Helmsley, the Greenwich Blue Blood, the Greenwich Snob. He beat child molester Buck Zumov in a match taped for Wrestling Challenge. 16 years ago this week, April 26, 1998, first WWE pay-per-view to use the current, soon-to-be-changed, Scratch logo. Backlash from Greensboro, North Carolina, saw The Undertaker beat Kane in the first ever Inferno match, setting his arm on fire, or at least the plastic bag that was clearly covering part of Kane's arm. And Dude Love beat Stone Cold Steve Austin by DQ in the main event, after Austin struck Vince McMahon right in the face with a steel chair. This is still my favorite Vince McMahon bump of all time, and he's taken quite a few over the years. I remember the place went apeshit when Austin nailed him. I mean, he clobbered him right in the face with that chair. Actually, it was probably more the forehead, but still. It looked great. And to see the owner of the company take that kind of bump back then, it just didn't happen. You know, I know Eric Bischoff took that great powerbomb bump from Nash at the Great American Bash that one time, but we're talking WWE here. You just didn't see that. And Vince sold it like he was dead. And he took another chair shot, too. He took another wicked chair shot to the head the next month in the Austin Dude Love rematch. That match was even better. In fact, that's one of my favorite matches in WWE history. That's the match I would show someone looking to become a new wrestling fan who knows nothing about pro wrestling, which might surprise some people to hear me say that. You know, it wasn't a great straight wrestling match or anything like that. It was a great brawl, though. I mean, that match had everything. I love that match, the over-the-edge match. 14 years ago this week, on April 22nd, 2000, ECW held its Cyber Slam event at the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, a show that saw Tommy Dreamer finally win the ECW title, beating Taz. He was in tears when the match was over. Gave an emotional speech when he was attacked by one half of the tag champs, Justin Credible. He had been part of the Impact Players with Lance Storm at the time. Credible challenged him to a title match right then and there, which Dreamer accepted. And Credible ended up winning the championship when Francine turned on Dreamer. So an early version of a Money in the Bank cash-in, only not really. So Dreamer, after years of trying, he finally wins the big one, only to have it ripped away from him before he ever really had a chance to be champion. I remember listening to Dreamer on an interview talk about how he was against the idea. He didn't even want to win the title. You know, to him, you know, Tommy Dreamer, the character, should have always been the guy who tries but fails to get to the top. But Paul Heyman insisted on it, so they did the angle. He lost it right away, so they could try to make a new star incredible. I don't know how many people took Aldo Montoya seriously as the ECW champion, but they tried. 12 years ago this week, on April 21st, 2002, WWE's Backlash pay-per-view, what I believe was the last ever match between Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Undertaker to determine the number one contender for the undisputed WWE Championship, with co-owner of Raw, Ric Flair, as the guest referee. Undertaker won, even though Austin got his foot on the ropes at the last minute. Flair didn't see it. And so backstage after the match, when Jonathan Coachman showed Flair a replay of what happened, you just see, it's like an exasperated Ric Flair just stands there watching this, and he just says, "Ah, shit," and he walks away. We also had Hollywood Hulk Hogan, just 1 month removed from his match with The Rock at WrestleMania, and a babyface turn, beating Triple H to win his sixth and final WWE title. I shouldn't say final. Hogan is under contract. You never know with Hulk Hogan. But I assume that will end up being his final championship. Which is amazing when you consider Triple H had been out with a quad injury for like 8 months, and they built to this big return, this big comeback, winning the title at WrestleMania against Jericho, and then a month later they just took it off him. They quickly realized all the heat that Hogan had, it was more nostalgia than anything else, because he could not sustain it, and so he lost the belt to The Undertaker the following month in a terrible match. 7 years ago this week, on April 23rd, 2007, John Cena and Shawn Michaels had one of the greatest matches in Raw history, going nearly an hour in a non-title WrestleMania rematch on Raw from London, England. Shawn slipped out of an FU attempt, caught Cena with a super kick to get the pin. Probably the best straight-up wrestling match that John Cena has ever had, although his Money in the Bank match with CM Punk is still my favorite Cena match. 6 years ago this week, finally, April 21st, 2008, I hate to end on a down note, but we're going to do that here. It was a three-hour episode of Monday Night Raw. Believe it or not, there was a time when 3 hours of Raw was a specialty. It was an attraction. It was the exception, not the rule. So this episode of Raw, they had to come up with a gimmick for this three-hour show, and what they did was they decided to bring back the King of the Ring. They brought back the tournament for the first time since 2006. They needed a gimmick to occupy the 3 hours, and so that was their idea, and they proceeded to crap all over it. First round matches included such classics as The Great Khali against Fit Finlay and William Regal against Hornswoggle. We did get a CM Punk Jericho match in the semifinals, but I just remember I remember watching this show, because I don't think I was even home. I think I was away. I was on a trip to Florida somewhere, and I'm watching it by myself in my hotel room. And I was looking forward to it, because I'm a big King of the Ring mark. I like King of the Ring. And I just remember watching this. The matches just got no time at all. Again, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And the matches just were not very good. Finals was CM Punk against William Regal, which you would think had the potential to be something special. But how could it be when you gave those guys 4 minutes? Punk tapped out to the Regal stretch to give Regal the win. Just a complete joke of a tournament. A complete insult to the whole King of the Ring concept. I mean, they had Hornswoggle in there, enough said. Why give some of those matches extra time when you could do a mock match pitting Hillary Clinton against Barack Obama? Yes, they actually had two lookalikes do a match together. It took Umaga, God rest his soul, to save us from this misery. He came out, he beat up Obama, and he gave Hillary a Samoan drop to end the segment at our mercy. So, yeah, that was quite the spectacle. And that was 6 years ago this week in wrestling history. You can send questions for the mailbag to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. And you can follow along on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle on there. We're all over Facebook. You can send me a friend request on my profile page, or get in on all the action on our Facebook group. It's a private group. You have to apply for membership. If you type in Solomonster Sounds Off, it is a private discussion group. And I want to mention this here. I plug the group. The group is awesome. We've got well over 2,200 members and growing each and every day, each and every hour. I'm getting new requests, but I just got to mention this here because there was some stuff I noticed going on the group page this week, and I just want to mention it here. No nudity and gay slurs, okay? This should go without saying that this stuff would not be allowed on the group page. But I actually saw some posts, and we're not talking about linking to anything. We're talking about posts that had some slightly nude images, and there was one person who, I don't think he meant ill or anything like that, but he used a certain word that is, taken as a gay slur. If it's used, I'll pull the post from now on. And if it happens again after that, I'll just get rid of you and you won't be back. It's that simple. That goes for everybody. I'm not going to put up any rules of the board, you know. You guys are mostly adults. I know we have some kids on there, but you're all smart enough to know what's probably allowed and what's not. And you know, if you violate those unwritten rules, then you'll be gone, and that's it. That's why it's a private group. Not just anybody can join. And if you're blocked or banned from the group, you don't come back. If you're going to be a bad influence, if you're going to cause problems, if you're going to, you know, insult people, and it's going to degenerate into these childish things, then we don't need that. I will not hesitate to give you a warning and then boot your ass out of the group. So just let that serve as fair warning, as far as that goes. But nonetheless, don't let that dissuade you from joining after that wonderful plug there. We do have a lot of good people in that group, so hopefully you'll be part of that. And we are on YouTube. I know I am due to get a new video up there soon. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll see some videos from our official channel come up there. We're closing in soon on 8,000 members on there, so thank you for that. If you want to know the different ways you can support the podcast, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you can always make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. It is safe. It is secure. You can give what you can. Every little bit helps. Or you can give Audible a try. We have a custom URL for the show, audibletrial.com/solomonster. If you sign up there, it's free 30-day trial. You get one free audiobook. You're not obligated to stick with it if you want to cancel. That's up to you, but just signing up for the free trial helps the show, whether you stick with it or not. It's a good service. I think you'll like it, but that's another way to support the show. And there's always the Sound Off Superstore. I don't mention that enough here on the show. We haven't gotten any new shirts up in recent weeks, but there's a whole bunch of shirts. There's some smartphone cases. We actually do have a store with some Sound Off merchandise, if you are not aware, if you are a new listener. So you can find it very easily at solomonster.spreadshirt.com. That's the URL. You can go there, place an order. It ships from all over the world. So if you live in the UK or if you live in Canada, that's not a problem. And check it out. I think you might like some of the stuff there. So we're going to wrap things up here for episode 325. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast, supporting the show in various ways, and sharing links and retweeting this when I put it up on Twitter, because we pick new listeners up every single week. A lot of those new listeners come from you guys, word of mouth, spreading the word to your friends and other people. And so I very much appreciate that. Next weekend is Extreme Rules weekend, so we'll have preview and predictions for the pay-per-view. That'll be on episode 326, along with all the late-breaking news in the world of wrestling. Hopefully we won't have any more stories of people dying or indie promoters screwing other guys over. We don't want to hear about that. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a good week, and we will see you right back here for a new episode next weekend of The Sound Off. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
I beat the authority, and right now I stand here as the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion!
The bad.
Brock Lesnar into the cover, hooks the leg, the streak is over.
And the ugly.
Well, we are here with the new married couple.
Now we're tag team partners for life.
Sean and Marty said the same thing once upon a time.
Oh, I knew he was going to do that.
What a despicable act that was.
Oh, my God.
Well, mostly the good.
Some Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monster Sound Off.